You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
What in the world is going on in Syria? I wish someone would go there and come back and tell us. Well, Judy Bello is on the Administrative Committee of the United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC, and a founding member of the Upstate Coalition to Ground the Drones and End the Wars. That's upstate New York. In the previous decade, she has traveled with peace delegations to Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, and Syria, and she has just returned from a fact-finding mission in Syria with a delegation from the U.S. Peace Council. Judy Bello, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. I'm really happy to be here.
It's great to have you on. You went to Syria. You met with President Assad, who claimed to be trying to end the fighting to achieve reconciliation. Was that believable?
I think it was, actually, or it is, I should say. It's not just President Assad who said that. We talked to Ali Haidar, who is the Minister of Reconciliation, who came into his post in 2012, and he was from a socialist opposition party, and he joined the government when the violence began, and because he did not want his people had started out the peaceful protest, and they did not want to be involved in the violence that followed from that, which they felt was coming from right-wing and foreign parties and had nothing to do with the real issues inside of Syria.
Is reconciliation going to be possible, given that the Syrian government, among others, is participating in war and dropping bombs on people?
Well, I think that it's not going to be easy, and they've had some successes. But they haven't, you know, they haven't really been able to unfold this in a fast or a big way, and I don't think they ever will. I think what it has to do with is the fact that the majority of Syrians remain within the government areas, and the many of the fighters are not Syrian, and therefore, as far as they're concerned, they're not, you know, war is the correct option for resisting these fighters who are being funded and armed by Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the United States, actually. So, but as far as the Syrians, though, many of them got sucked into the war in kind of strange ways. Like, in some cases, they're just all this fighting broke out, and these people found themselves at odds with their neighbors and joined in with the fighting. And there were calls from Qatar again through the Muslim Brotherhood. They were willing to pay anyone that was willing to join the war, and they were promising that there would be a grand new world and that these people who are largely among the poorer and, you know, people in Syria who had more problems would suddenly be the rulers of the country. And so there were a lot of things going on. Some people, when they took over various cities and towns, they said, either join us or you'll be killed. And so people joined that side. And so there were a whole lot of reasons why there are people fighting in Syria that happened to be actually be Syrian and not part of the military.
Yeah.
So the Syrian government's plan is to bring these people, to offer these people an amnesty and an opportunity to be restored to Syrian society. And actually quite a few people have taken them up on it. And they had one fairly large success in Homs, where they cleared the what they call the terrorists. They never use any word except terrorists to describe them, from a neighborhood that was had been occupied since sometime in early 2012. And there, I think it was like, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand people living there, and 3,000 militants, I'll call them militants,
sure,
who are essentially occupying the area. And there's no amnesty, as I say, for the foreigners, but for the ones that are actually Syrian, they eventually made an arrangement where those who wanted to stay and lay down their arms were allowed to do that, and those who did not want to capitulate, so to speak, to the government's stance, were allowed to take their families, and they were bused to Idlib. Now, this is I have some questions about this scenario, since Idlib is now, of course, a hotbed of fighting at this point. But so essentially, though, what they did is they cleared this neighborhood of several hundred thousand people and freed them from an oppressive force that was controlling the neighborhoods, like having the mafia be the government, and restored them to the normal governance of the city. So that was one of their bigger successes. And they've had in small ways, they use the same network of people who are associated with like the different aid groups as well as the military to reach out, because some of them are people who have already fled these regions, so they're from the region. They send them, essentially, they have them make contact with the people who live there, and through the people who live there, they try to make contact with fighters who are on the edge and who are related to the community, and they sort of try to grow, and then they start sending in resources and assistance to the community through those people. And they according to what Minister Haidar told us, they basically try to build popular committees. They're doing a very socialist kind of thing, build popular committees that will support the community and that will overlap into the militants and provide them with an opportunity to rejoin the community before the lines are drawn, okay, who's going to be in a fight and who's going to stay with the community under the protection of the military.
Well, this all sounds excellent, Judy. And I want to get to the United States and others' disastrous roles in this country. But did you ask Assad or anyone else in the Syrian government about their own acts of war, their own crimes, Russia's reports of cluster bombs and firebombs and so on?
Well, we did ask them. And essentially, their answer is that this is a war, and they have to protect the majority of the Syrian people, and that they cannot turn their country over to an extremist and a group of people who are not representative of Syria and Syrian values, and who do represent a very, very small minority of Syrians and a large number of external players. And so, and it did occur to me when they were saying this, and I don't use it to justify necessarily war, but I do, I personally believe that in self-defense. And it, of course, this has turned so ugly and so messy that it's hard to say where the line might be drawn. But essentially, their stance is that in every possible opportunity, they try to bring the civilians out of areas before they send their fighters in. And so anyone who they're fighting is part of this force that is terrorizing, essentially, the Syrian people. And in Aleppo, this is very clear, because all the while we've been hearing all these reports about hospitals being bombed and this and that. One has to understand that this is a very small, small, like, percentage of the population of Aleppo, and that they aren't operating in the main hospitals. They are operating in clandestine hospitals, and they are continually shelling civilian neighborhoods in the government-held area of Aleppo. And in fact, even in Damascus, while I was there, there was shelling in one of the neighborhoods, again, near the edge, near the suburbs of Damascus, maybe in the area where around Ghouta, where a lot of the militants live. And they shelled a restaurant at dinner time, and they killed 11 people, and including a woman, a pregnant woman, and her little child. And it was a terrible report when it happened. And actually, Eva Bartlett, who's a Canadian reporter who I know who's there, was living a couple blocks away. So this is ongoing all the time, continuously, and none of this comes to the Western news. So this really is like, this isn't a war that Syria is making alone on groups of people that are just hiding out trying to get away from them. This is a war where people are attacking on the boundary and the Syrian military retaliating.
Yeah.
And civilians are being killed on both sides.
That's the point. There are always atrocities on both sides, and we don't need to counter biased communications with bias in the other direction. Well, we've got less than 4 minutes left. Hillary Clinton and her advisors are still talking about overthrowing the Syrian government. What happened? I mean, what will happen if that, you know, occurs? What are the possible results?
Well, the outcome will surely be, because they want to turn the power over to this Saudi-led group of people, what's going to happen is similar to what happened in Iraq and Libya. It's going to be the destruction of the country. And worse than Iraq is, at least in Iraq, the faction that's ruling, although they're not doing a very good job of it, is one of the native factions in the country that's quite strong. Whereas in Syria, this will be a very small minority, taking over and oppressing a people in a secular, liberal country where people are educated and where the high religious people, there's a very strong Orthodox Christian representation in Syria. The Mufti is a Sunni, and he's a very high-level scholar. And his son has already been killed by these people because he preached peace with the other sects inside of Syria. So it's a very, very sad situation. And the fueling it with arms, and this is the bottom line, is that by fueling it with arms and protecting U.S. allies, they continue to send fighters in there to fight against the legitimate elected government of Syria, is a crime against humanity. It's a crime of the highest degree, according to the Nuremberg people, who said that aggression and starting a war is the highest crime that there is.
And not just arms and fighters, but also sanctions, right? Is sanctioning Syrian government and the Syrian people helpful at this point?
No, because it's mostly affecting the people, and they tell you they're only sanctioning rich people. But what's happened is they've closed down the international banking system to Syria so that they cannot use dollars. So it's similar to what was done in Iraq and Iran. Iran is a bigger country with a more robust economy to begin with, but they can't get supplies for the factories. Factories that have machines they bought in, say, Europe that need to be tweaked once a year to keep functioning have fallen down because the owners can't get the Europeans to come and fix them. They can't get the raw materials they need for manufacturing. So factories have to close and lay people off. Meanwhile, other factories are being blown up by the insurgents. Almost all of the factories in Aleppo have been shut down by the militants. The sanctions keep them from getting medicine. They can't get any cancer drugs anymore. They can't, the students from the university system of Syria aren't allowed to do exchanges anymore. The students and faculty with any external countries, with any Western countries. The Lawyers Guild no longer has any international standing, and therefore they can't stay considered taking their issues to the international court. They are just completely shut out of international commerce. They still, though, have their representative in the United Nations, and I think that's because the General Assembly would never tolerate having them kicked out.
There is much to be done, Judy, and we appreciate your going and filling us in, and we will have to have you back after your next trip around the world. Judy Bellow, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David.
It is my great pleasure to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio, Gar Alperovitz. He has been a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, and Harvard's Institute of Politics. He is the author of critically acclaimed books on the atomic bomb. Alperovitz has served as a legislative director in both houses of Congress and as a special assistant in the State Department. He is the president of the National Center for Economic and Security Alternatives, co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative, and co-chair of the Next System Project. And he will be speaking at No War 2016, a conference that we at World Beyond War are organizing in September in Washington, D.C. See worldbeyondwar.org. Gar Alperovitz, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
Great to be back, David.
Great to hear you. We have just been recently past another anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is an issue you've looked at closely for years. What do you make of the current state of nuclear armament and hopes for disarmament?
Well, we've gotten almost no progress at all during the Obama years, unfortunately, and the president's committed to basically a $1 trillion increase over the next 10 years in nuclear rearming or modernization is the terms they use. So I think things are in dire straits on the nuclear. We've been very, very, very lucky so far that someone has not triggered use of these weapons, and I think we're skating on thin ice. We have yet to find a president who's willing to make this a high top priority. Hopefully, at some point, we'll be able to build enough of a peace movement to make that happen.
We'll have a workshop at the No War 2016 conference, looking at the possibility of a global treaty to ban nukes, which is gaining some popularity outside of the nuclear nations. What do you think of that strategy?
Well, I think it's time to raise those questions. We had a Secretary of State and three or four major, you know, top insiders make that proposal several years ago. So there's no way to go forward without making demands of that kind. I definitely support the effort to try to do that.
Wonderful. We know that you have worked on Capitol Hill. Did you see any good wars while you were up there?
You know, I happened to work in the United States Senate at the time the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was jammed through the Senate by the Johnson administration.
Yeah.
And it was obvious at the time that it was a fraud, that the president and his advisors knew that there was no significant attack, and they used this as a way to jam a resolution giving them full authority to go to war in the Congress. The senator I worked for, and I drafted an amendment to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution saying that any response to these two torpedo boats that may be attacked or maybe didn't attack in the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, that any U.S. response should be measured and fitting to whatever happened. In other words, not much happened, so the response shouldn't be major. There was an acceptance of that language as the meaning of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, but the Johnson administration ignored it entirely and simply went to war. So I've seen it up close, and it's not a pretty story. It's the same thing that happened with Iraq, where some pretense was created to go to war, and then thousands, including maybe millions of lives, get lost.
Shouldn't one of the lessons have been that, you know, even if all the lies had been true and the weapons had been there, that didn't legally, morally, practically justify a war? And even if Vietnamese ships had shot back at U.S. ships off the coast of Vietnam, that didn't constitute aggression against the United States? Because here we are with Russian planes flying near U.S. planes off the coasts of Russia, being told that this is somehow aggression against the United States, as though we've learned nothing. Are there ways that these lessons can finally be learned, that not only do they lie to us, but they ask the wrong question to begin with?
No, I totally agree with you. That's exactly what happened in the Vietnam Gulf of Tonkin resolution, that even if you accept the administration's position, there was no reason to, you know, 3 million lives were lost in that war, mostly, peasants in Vietnam, people who lived there, 3 million people. You know, if you look at what happened in Iraq, you've got the same kind of question going on. It's way, way exaggerated and out of hand, even if you accept the argument of the other side.
Yeah, I've seen 3.8 million in a Harvard study and millions more in Cambodia and Laos where the war was taken. What do you make of possible relationships between the work that you're doing these days on reforming economic structures and our ability as public in a supposedly representative government to end things we oppose, like outrageous militarism?
Well, I think you need a policy that walks on two legs. One is, you know, to rebuild and re-energize a serious peace movement. And that's the kind of work that the conference hopefully is going to stimulate in the work you've been doing all along. On the other hand, the underlying institutional structures, the gigantic military budget and all of the institutions that go with it are lined up in a certain direction that kind of prejudges in the direction of war. It's an institutional problem, not just an attitudinal problem. And there's a lot of money and a lot of people and a lot of organization built that way. And secondly, on not so much on the nuclear front, but interventions in many third world nations, the corporate structure gets us into situations where some particular leadership that they like and we like gets backed, and then if there's a problem, we get sucked into some kind of support role, or we try to overthrow them, as in Venezuela. So the underlying institutional problems of the corporate capitalist systems like our own tend to get us into trouble abroad. And there's a long literature on this repeated again and again and again over time. So changing the underlying institutions, reconstructing the system, is a long-term goal. And there are many other reasons why the systemic crisis, climate change, inequality, racism, a lot of other issues that are posing the system question for the first time, certainly in my life. And I think there's a movement building up to begin thinking seriously about that step by step and working from the bottom up.
How central do you think the communication system problem is? I mean, here you are someone who's looked at these issues from different angles and written critically acclaimed books for years, and I don't see you or people like you on CNN or MSNBC every time there's a push for a new war. I see so-called retired generals still in the pay of the arms industries.
Well, it's true to a substantial degree that the media controls that, but, you know, there is an alternative media, which never existed until, you know, 10 years ago, where the Internet began allowing a movement to build irrespective of the mass media. So I think, you know, we've got at least some openings on that front, and every now and then you see MSNBC allowing a critic of the current situation come in, and I think we need to press more of that. And if we get into fighting war, I suspect we're going to see more of it. There's a lot of discontent.
Yeah, it's certainly true, and I'm grateful to all the stations that air this program. You know, this is alternative media, but we have a long ways to go. What do you see as the prospects for building a movement across issues for reform of all the systems that need reform, including a movement to get rid of the institution of war? That is, not to reform it or fix it or Geneva Conventionize or Samantha Powerize it, but to abolish it.
Well, I think, you know, what the Bernie Sanders phenomenon showed is that there's a far deeper concern in this country than most people really recognize. Iowa housewives calling themselves Democratic Socialists was not expected when the campaign started. And, you know, large numbers of people, but sometimes 40 to 50% in certain polls, calling themselves Democratic Socialists. Now, there's a lot of what does that really mean? One thing we know it suggests is openness to a different approach. And I think this is a time to push as hard as we can to open up some of the really critical issues and kind of combine it with the buildup of this progressive movement that's growing. That's at one level, and then there's another level which is much more radical and on the organizing level. So, you know, as always, it's just a matter of rolling up your sleeves and getting down to work. But I do think that there's a much bigger opening than we've ever seen, at least in my lifetime.
Do you think that if Senator Sanders had really made a really different foreign policy part of his campaign, a foreign policy he himself might have supported decades back, or if Jill Stein or other candidates are permitted in the televised debates, do you think that that if foreign policy and a different peace-directed foreign policy were part of the discussion, that people would show a similar surprising willingness to move in a different direction as they showed on the economic issues?
I would not be surprised if we got a very powerful response if some of the issues were dramatized. I mean, the nuclear question in particular is just hanging there. It is extremely dangerous, you know, the possibilities of error with these weapons that could destroy, you know, all of New York State, not just New York City, with one bomb. So I think that's hanging there and could be opened up in the same way that Bernie opened up some of the economic issues. We haven't yet done it, and it may take an accident to do it, but I think it's a very important time to really assume that people can hear something in the way that they've heard the economic message and attempt to drive the message home. This is a very important moment in our development.
I couldn't agree more. We have just a couple minutes left. I don't know if you've read Mikhail Gorbachev's new book, but I was struck in that book by his comment that we're never going to get rid of nuclear weapons as long as the United States maintains such incredible dominance of the world in so-called conventional weapons, in non-nuclear weapons. That is, unless the United States leaves this war footing of seeking dominance of the globe with all the other weapons that are actually used more frequently so far, thank goodness, we're not going to be able to get rid of the nuclear weapons. I don't hear that much from the very best people working on nuclear weapons abolition.
No, he's got a. I would not overdo that point, but it certainly is an important point because if you listen to it one way, it means there's no hope unless you get rid of the conventional stance. If you look at it another way, I think you've got to do both simultaneously. Enough of the interventions with conventional forces. And simultaneously re-raise the nuclear issue. It's been dormant as a political issue, and I think it's time to really open that up again. Just as the economic issue has been opened up unexpectedly, it may very well be that we can open the nuclear issue and the intervention issue. It's a very open moment in our history. We should assume there's openness until shown that you can't break through.
It seems we have about a minute left. It seems the biggest elephant in the room, unmentioned, is the spending on the nuclear and all other militarism. Over half of federal discretionary spending, all other economic issues somehow managed to get discussed without mentioning that. Is there a way that we can put that into the discussion?
Well, I think the libertarians are the ones who've raised it. You know, they actually go after it on budgetary matters. I do think that there's an opening. It's so huge, and there's so many other needs that I do think all of this is open if we open it. I think the era when these things could not be talked about, I think, is fading. So I think this is a particularly open period of history to at least attempt to push as hard as we can.
Well, I appreciate the libertarians opposing bad spending. I just wish they didn't oppose good spending, too. You take what you can get, and you work in the coalitions you can build. Gar Alpovitz, thanks for everything you've been doing, and I look forward to seeing you in Washington, D.C. in September.
Great, and thank you for your work, David.
Thank you. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, it was 20 years ago this month that Bill Clinton eliminated the federal guarantee of assistance to poor families. Corporate media played a key role in persuading the public that aid to families with dependent children, representing less than 1.5% of federal outlay from 1964 to 1994, was nevertheless bleeding the country dry. Now we're told we're in a moment of reconsideration, of tough-on-crime policies, of the deregulation of banks, and perhaps of the notion that depriving needy people of assistance would lead to their gainful employment and well-being. Our guest says a true reconsideration of the 1990s welfare overhaul would require a so far invisible recentering of the people in its crosshairs, low-income women, particularly mothers raising children on their own. Felicia Kornbluh is Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont and President of the Faculty Union, United Academics. She's author of The Battle for Welfare Rights and, with Gwendolyn Mink, of the forthcoming Ensuring Poverty, The History and Politics of Welfare Reform. Felicia Kornbluh will join us today on Counterspin to talk about what's missing from even Democratic debate about the social safety net. That's coming up, but first, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. How the Most Dangerous Place on Earth Got Safer was the headline over the lead article in the New York Times Week in Review, August 11th, with a teaser reading, "Programs funded by the United States are helping transform Honduras. Who says American power is dead?" Well, the piece never gets really around to explaining how Honduras became the most dangerous place on Earth. That's American power, too. The Times' Sonia Nazario reported a remarkable reduction in violence in Honduras, much of it thanks to programs funded by the United States that have helped community leaders tackle crime. She cited U.S.-funded anti-violence programs in a neighborhood of the city San Pedro Sula. Quote, "The United States has provided local leaders with audio speakers for events, tools to clear 10 abandoned soccer fields that had become dumping grounds for bodies, notebooks and school uniforms, and funding to install streetlights and trash cans." Close quote. This is evidence that smart investments in Honduras are succeeding, which is a striking rebuke to the rising isolationists in American politics, who seem to have lost their faith in American power. That's the Times' poorly veiled effort to show that the piece is a swipe at Donald Trump, except it's also an insult to anybody with a memory. In the early 2000s, the murder rate in Honduras fluctuated between 44 and 61 per 100,000. That's very high by global standards, but it was similar to rates in neighboring El Salvador and Guatemala. And it's not coincidental that all three countries were dominated by violent, U.S.-backed right-wing governments in the 1980s. That's historical context that this op-ed entirely omits. Then, in June of 2009, Honduras' left-leaning president Manuel Zelaya was overthrown in a military coup, kidnapped, and flown out of the country via the joint U.S.-Honduran military base at Palmarola. Well, the U.S. is supposed to cut off aid to a country that has a military coup, and there is no doubt that Zelaya's ouster constituted an illegal and unconstitutional coup, according to a secret report sent by the U.S. ambassador to Honduras in 2009, later exposed by WikiLeaks. But the U.S. continued most aid to Honduras, carefully avoiding the magic words military coup that would have necessitated withdrawing support from the regime. In her memoir, Hard Choices, Hillary Clinton recalled how, as Secretary of State, she worked behind the scenes to legitimate the new regime. In the days following the coup, Clinton wrote, quote, I spoke with my counterparts around the hemisphere, including Secretary Espinosa in Mexico. We strategized on a plan to restore order in Honduras and ensure that free and fair elections could be held quickly and legitimately, which would render the question of Zelaya moot, close quote. With a corrupt, drug-linked regime in place, thanks in large part to U.S. intervention, murder in Honduras soared, rising to 91.4 in 2001. That's fully 50% above the pre-coup level. Well, many of those murders involved criminal gangs, but much of the post-coup violence was political, with resuscitated death squads targeting journalists, opposition figures, labor activists, and environmentalists, of whom indigenous leader Berta Cáceres was only the most famous. At one point, it seemed that the Times was going to acknowledge the U.S. role in creating the problems it gives American power credit for ameliorating. Quote, we are also repairing harms the United States inflicted, close quote, Nazario writes. But the explanation was strangely circumscribed. The harms were, quote, first by deporting tens of thousands of gangsters to Honduras over the past two decades, a decision that fueled much of the recent mayhem, and second by our continuing demand for drugs, which are shipped from Colombia and Venezuela through Honduras, close quote. So, no mention of the U.S. supporting the Honduran coup or the political murders of the U.S.-backed regime. About three-quarters of the way through, we do get this, quote, it will take much more than this project to change the reputation of the United States in this part of the world, where we are famous for exploiting workers and resources and helping to keep despots in power, close quote. But is that the U.S.'s reputation or its history? And surely it's relevant that some of the despots the U.S. helped keep in power were in the country that Nazario is reporting from, and that this led directly to the problem she's reporting about. Well, the New York Times has covered much of this history in an op-ed by Professor Dana Frank 4 years ago, but now that information appears to be down the memory hole, leaving the paper free to tout donations of trash cans and school uniforms as an advertisement for American power. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. August 22nd, 20 years ago, Bill Clinton signed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, designed to end welfare as we know it, which it did. Looking back, a New York Times retro report this May treated as novel the recognition that though welfare rolls were reduced in the wake of the act, poverty was not. That for those who could find jobs, wages were insufficient to lift them from poverty, and that, quote, all too often they had a hard time staying employed when the economy soured, close quote. The piece also says that those using assistance found themselves characterized as loafers and cheats, with no hint of just who was broadcasting such characterizations. Well, none of this is news to the many who criticized the act at the time and ever since. The question is, what will we do about it? Those who remember the welfare reform debate remember that it's centered on unmarried women with children, overwhelmingly depicted as women of color. Newsweek's Jonathan Alter said that to this group of poor mothers could be traced every threat to the fabric of this country. Diane Sawyer said, to many people, these girls are public enemy number one. Low-income women were and are the target of so-called reform. So if we're really reconsidering it, shouldn't we start with them? Felicia Kornbluh is Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont and President of the Faculty Union, United Academics. She's the author of The Battle for Welfare Rights and, with Gwendolyn Mink, of the upcoming Ensuring Poverty, The History and Politics of Welfare Reform. Welcome back to Counterspin, Felicia Kornbluh.
Delighted to be here.
Well, while candidates don't usually get very specific, the election season gives us a chance to see where politicians and parties' priorities lie. So as you watch the current political conversation, thinking about low-income women and particularly single heads of households, what do you see? What's there for them?
What I see is absence. I don't know if that's a thing that one can see. It's something I perceive in the mainstream political discourse and then mirrored right back in mainstream media. And unfortunately, even though in some ways I was very sympathetic and very sympathetic to the Bernie Sanders movement, Sanders's rhetoric and the media who covered him also didn't really capture it. You know, a class-based politics, a traditional class-based politics, a traditional social democratic politics doesn't reach the folks who were most damaged by welfare reform, and it doesn't reach the real problems.
Well, you call it the hole in the middle of the donut. There's a way that you can address workplace issues and you can address sexism, sort of, and yet you can still leave what you might call the intersection out.
Yeah, this is the big disappointment that I had over this whole last political season. The week that he announced his candidacy, Bernie Sanders was being kind of beset by the Hillary Clinton people who were courting all the Democrats in our state, in Vermont. So a lot of Democratic office holders came out for Hillary right before Sanders was going to announce his candidacy. And Phil Fermonti, the field director of the Sanders campaign, contacted me as a labor leader and contacted a lot of other similar folks about endorsing right away. And the first question I asked was, is he going to talk about welfare reform? And they didn't answer the question. And I asked again, is he going to talk about welfare reform? And they didn't answer the question. And that was, you know, a little bit emblematic. And the Hillary Clinton people, they didn't, I guess, need to ask for my support. So I never had that conversation with them. But I did lobby Hillary when she was in the Senate on this issue. And she refused to meet with our delegation of feminist academics. And when I said to one of her staff people that we didn't consider welfare reform to be a feminist act, and if she wanted to call herself a feminist, she had to take some real action on this. Like, they basically slammed the door in my face. They were so angry at me. I mean, certainly a Trump politics is horrible. But even the two main camps of Democratic politics, on the one hand, kind of social democratic and class-based, Bernie Sanders-y, and the other, the Hillary Clinton one, which is, right, sort of gender sensitive and sort of racially sensitive. And there was all that, like, nice, touching stuff at the Democratic National Convention about people whose stories wouldn't be possible anywhere but America because they're African-American and their parents were, you know, working class or whatever. Like, that stuff is all very heartwarming, but it does not reach these issues. It does not talk about systemic, structural, ongoing ways in which our society is generating poverty and inequality. And it's generating it way more for low-income women of color than it is for anybody else.
Well, let's talk about that. And what's outside this frame that what we need to do is put people to work and pay them fairly, which no one is against, but it leaves out certain realities about the relationship between the workforce and the actual economy and people's actual lives.
Yeah, what we seem to have forgotten, strangely, is that our economy and our society are actually generating enormous, enormous wealth right now. The tech economy is generating enormous profit, and that seems likely to go on. The problem is, of course, that that's not being distributed fairly. There's no reason that we should be creating jobs where we don't need to create jobs. What we need to do is recognize, right, that the jobs we have, the industries we have, are highly, highly productive in the sense that per every worker, they're producing an enormous amount of stuff and an enormous amount of wealth. Like, that's fine. But then we just need to, like, move the money around. And there's no reason in the world that we can't, as a society, say, look, there are some things that people do outside of the conventional labor market that are very socially valuable. You know, raising your kids, that's very socially valuable. Taking care of your ill and elderly parents, other family members or friends, like, it's very socially valuable. Why should we create a whole nursing home industry when there are people who would rather do that work for their own kin? Why should we create a childcare industry in which, by the way, the employees are almost always dramatically underpaid and overworked? Like, why do we create that industry and demand that people put their kids in childcare when instead people would actually be pretty happy, a lot of folks would be pretty happy to take care of their own children? It's built out of a very deep social forgetting, and it's built on racism and sexism.
And the idea that it's not noblesse oblige, it's not that we create this value and then, hey, we've got it. Perhaps we could distribute it in a way to be generous. It's really that these people that we're talking about who reproduce the labor force, as you say, as mothers do, as parents do, contribute to this value that we're talking about. They contribute to this economy that and this productivity.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And if we go back, you know, not that far back in our history, as Bernie Sanders reminded us in his campaign, you know, in the Eisenhower years, for example, under a Republican president, taxes were dramatically higher than they are today. And then the money was redistributed. Well, you know, a lot of it went to the so-called defense industry. That's not so great. But it went to a lot of other things as well. And I think the reason was that there was an understanding that our society as a whole, the framework of it, the you know, the roads and the bridges and the different kinds of educational opportunities that are paid for, at least in part, through public sources, like that those all contribute to whatever wealth there is.
Exactly. And, you know, when we look back at how we got to where we are, the New York Times says the political stars aligned, you know, in 1996. And that was what generated this Reform Act. But we, you and I, have talked about it a year ago as an intentional choice that was made. And we've talked about how we have an opportunity and we need to kind of reopen that moment in which the Democratic Party said, essentially, we're going to throw certain people under the bus, you know, we're going to save the party by people who are incarcerated, people who are on welfare, we're sort of set aside consciously. And now when we talk about that, we sort of say, oh, you know, it didn't quite work out the way we wanted, but it's not good enough to kind of whistle past it and say, oh, how can we patch up the holes that were left? We really need to revisit that moment and think about the choice that was made.
Yeah, I think it would be more accurate to describe it as a kind of original sin of the modern Democratic Party. And we have to think, I think, simultaneously about welfare reform, about NAFTA, the trade deal, about the 1994 crime bill. And we have to understand all those things as being sort of a piece. You know, it wasn't accidental. And it wasn't even just a matter, I think, of short-term political strategy. It was a worldview that was internationalist in a very pro-corporate, pro-business way. And, you know, neoliberalism is a term that's thrown around a lot, but I think that's the most accurate way to describe it. It was neoliberal in the sense of like being against any kind of protective trade barriers and sort of in favor of a, you know, a small state that would throw people on the well-being of the labor market. Everybody I know said that it was going to be a disaster, and that's pretty much the way it's turned out.
Well, and that takes me on to another point. This New York Times retro report described the 1990s as a time of tough-on-crime policies and loosening regulation on banks, and they described that as ideas that were kind of consensed upon at the time but that are now being attacked nearly daily, you know, now in 2016. That's bothersome because, of course, many people are not just now questioning crime policy or banking policy and likewise are not saying, gee, it turns out that cutting welfare and cutting assistance didn't actually in the long term reduce poverty. We can't accept this revisionist history of who was for what and whether we all agreed. I mean, that seems important, too.
It's very important. It's very important. And I think that's a media failing. I think it's a failing of liberal interest groups, too. Like in the labor movement, for example, which I'm part of, labor groups are not willing to go back and say, hey, you know, we support Democrats, but in the 90s, we were fighting with the Democrats about many of these issues. And they're not willing to withhold their support. They're not willing to stand up and say, we were betrayed by you guys, you know, and the same thing for all those nice liberal think tanks in Washington that are all dependent on foundation money, which reduces their ability to really critique things. You know, they had a wide array of opinions about these issues in the 90s, about welfare reform and about the rise of the carceral state, as we call it, and about these trade deals. Now it's all kind of small bore, like how can we help states survive in the climate as it exists? You know, how can we find one little tweak here or there? How can we prevent the next depredation from occurring? And we need to go back and like open it all up, have some kind of truth and reconciliation kind of encounter about this. Like, it's not okay. We didn't agree back then. We fought furiously. You know, my side was defeated and my side was right.
Yeah. Well, the New York Times in that piece says that liberals, they call them liberals, thought that welfare reform presaged misfortune. And I have trouble with both of those words. Misfortune, I think, is an inapt description of hardships that result from conscious policy. But also presaged, it sort of implies that critics were looking at a crystal ball, when in fact they were basing their concerns on social science, on what we knew about what happens when you reduce cash assistance, when you, you know, offer assistance in various forms. There was science on that. And, you know, the question I think is, why does one anecdote continue to outweigh a dozen studies? Why does not all of this social science work that's been done break through?
Well, that's a good question. And I think to some degree, it's hard. Like, I'm not really sure why. I've been reading a lot of recent books on poverty this summer. Matthew Desmond at Harvard has this great book called Evicted about people who are losing their housing. A slightly older book by the very important sociologist from Berkeley, Lois Wacquant, about the relationship between welfare policy and incarceration and criminal, so-called criminal justice policy. There is good work out there by very prominent people. And even people like this guy Desmond at Harvard has gotten a lot of attention. And yet it seems to operate in one sphere. There's a poverty conversation going off in a corner somewhere. And then there's this other conversation about politics or what's reasonable to expect from the Democrats or what's acceptable from a candidate like Hillary Clinton, you know. And those don't seem to overlap very much.
I think that's exactly right. It almost has to do with beats, you know, because I think of this piece by Eduardo Porter last year at the New York Times that was the myth of welfare's corrupting influence on the poor. And it really was an amassing of social science research on this particular question of how cash assistance is spent, you know, which really gets to a lot of the moralizing arguments, you know. And what he wound up saying was, evidence has not caught up with the popular belief that welfare reform was a huge success. And this is a reporter in the New York Times, you know, but still talking about a climate of opinion that is affected by media. So the information is out there, and yet it somehow doesn't redirect the narrative.
Yeah. And I think thinking about it in terms of poverty without nuancing it in a careful way so that we know that we're really talking about race and gender here.
Right.
You know, doesn't help either. Like that when we pretend that there's some kind of a neutral poverty conversation, like that's not true. There's a kind of a scrim or a cover of a racialized and gendered understanding that is operating here that I think a lot of people are really committed to, whether they realize it or not. And I think a lot of it also is, you know, mainstream media people and some academics, they ask the wrong question. And the question you ask produces certain results. So if the question is, did welfare reform reduce the welfare rolls? Then the answer is, yeah, that was what it was designed to do. None of us would have claimed otherwise 20 years ago. We all knew that was going to happen. When you put a whole bunch of strictures in place and you make it difficult for people to access welfare and you make it easy to throw them off the rolls and you create incentives for the states and localities to throw them off, then people get thrown off the rolls or they leave the rolls because they don't want to be harassed. And then you reduce the welfare rolls. Like if you consider that success, then you're just kind of you're stuck in your hamster wheel. We need to ask different questions and we need to insist that the media and politicians ask different questions.
And what are those different questions?
Well, we need to talk about people's well-being. We now know from really good data that some people who are in the labor market have done better, not through the magic of the labor market, but because the Clinton administration and subsequent administrations increased the earned income tax credit. So they're actually, we could call it welfare, actually, or we could call it transfer payments. Like there actually is money being funneled to the lower end of the waged labor market through the earned income tax credit and other kinds of incentives, and that is making some people less poor. if they're old, you know, if they have some wage earnings, some labor market earnings, they also are getting an earned income credit, which for some people is like more than they're earning. So we're subsidizing the low-wage labor market. We're allowing employers to pay people crappy, crappy wages, and the federal government is helping. But then for people who are not in the labor market, we know that what we're facing now is extreme immiseration. People are just completely falling off the charts. They're selling their blood. They're selling their bodies. They're engaging in petty drug crime. You know, that's why the numbers of women in jail are going up faster than the numbers of men in jail. That's why we have women losing their kids to foster care. It is fueling the drug crisis. It's, you know, it is a world of misery. And as a society, we have to take some responsibility for that.
Let me just ask you finally, I've heard the idea from folks from the Mobilization for Black Lives and elsewhere. It's just what you're just talking about, the idea of keeping our focus on the most vulnerable, those with multiple vulnerabilities as kind of the hallmarks of change. Because it's easy to imagine policies that would leave them behind, but work that would uplift them would almost certainly uplift others as well. And there could be something in that for media, talking about life as if, in this case, as if poor women matter.
Right. It's almost the opposite to the sort of liberal dream of the Bill Clinton era. The liberal dream of the Bill Clinton era was that somehow the Democratic Party could usher in universalistic policies. Like, this was their idea with Hillary Clinton's healthcare plan and Bill Clinton's healthcare plan, that they would create some kind of universal benefit, class blind, gender blind, and that would incidentally, without us having to talk about race and gender, that would incidentally help folks on the bottom. Didn't turn out that way. And I think what we've learned is that, at least in the United States, we can't play that way. We have to start the other way around. Reporters have to be willing to ask those questions, and citizens have to be willing to ask those questions. Like, what is happening to people who are on the bottom? And the more, I think it's absolutely right, the more we raise up their standard of living, the more we make it possible for everybody to survive in a decent way, to balance work and family responsibilities, to have some time for reflection, some time for a decent life, to preserve our health and our well-being in a really robust way.
Felicia Kornbluh's book is The Battle for Welfare Rights and forthcoming with Gwendolyn Mink, Ensuring Poverty, The History and Politics of Welfare Reform. Felicia Kornbluh, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio EcoShock, we're going to look at a life that shaped energy expectations, a whole social movement, an American military policy in the Middle East, as it turns out. Finally, there is a biography of M. King Hubbard, the man who warned oil companies and the world about peak oil. We'll ask author Mason Inman about the man, his legacy, and what it means now in this brief time of oil glut. Then I'll check in with Australian extreme weather specialist Lisa Alexander to get her measure of the record-setting Indian heat wave, which is now cooling to the monsoon rains. First, a couple of news notes. 2 weeks ago, we talked about Exelon, America's largest power company, demanding more subsidy to keep its aging reactors going in the state of Illinois. With no public support and no action from the legislature, Exelon has now announced two Illinois nuclear plants will close. The Quad Cities reactors were built in 1972 using the same faulty General Electric Mark I reactor design as the four reactors which blew up at Fukushima, Japan. One more of those darn reactors gone, with 22 left running in the United States. The other Illinois nuclear plant, the Clinton reactor, was built later in 1987 with a different design, but it was also plagued with safety issues. Illinois has not and will not go dark. Electricity from cheaper natural gas plants and, increasingly, wind power delivered from the Midwest will power that state with far less chance of an accident that lasts for thousands of years. The late anti-nuclear campaigner Michael Marriott battled against these reactors for years, including on Radio EcoShock, and now he's won. Over to California. You remember the giant natural gas reservoir that spewed methane into the skies of California and the world atmosphere? The Aliso Canyon storage facility is still closed. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has expressed concerns that California could experience rolling blackouts this summer as hotter days mean more power demand for air conditioning, and it's simmering in that state right now. It's a state drowning in potential solar power sites. Too bad it's not realized yet. Of course, no sooner did the Indian heat wave give way than Europe was hit with another extreme rainfall event. Parts of Paris flooded, as you know. The historic Louvre Museum had to move some of its priceless collection. People were swept away and died in the same extreme rain system in Germany, and that's following a storm that dropped over 300,000 lightning strikes in Europe. I could bounce from one extreme weather event to the next until Radio EcoShock becomes a kind of weather porn station. Except I try to find the climate science behind these abnormal twists when major media fails to tell us what is causing it all. Anyway, not this week. We have the story of M. King Hubbard, the man who changed so many of our lives.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Oil and gas and coal will not last forever, and a civilization built on those fuels cannot last forever either. But for how long and then what? That's the question asked by the peak oil movement, after it was answered by one of the energy giants of the 20th century. In the 1950s, while working for Shell Oil, the American geologist and geophysicist M. King Hubbard described the curve of fossil fuels. After being ignored, he was rediscovered in the 1970s, but few people know much about the man or really understand his theory. Only now has the first authoritative biography of M. King Hubbard emerged. It's by Mason Inman, an award-winning science writer who's been published in everything from Scientific American to Wired magazine. The title of the book is The Oracle of Oil, A Maverick Geologist's Quest for a Sustainable Future. Mason, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's get a bit of a snapshot to start. Why did you spend the last 5 years chasing down this biography of M. King Hubbard?
Well, part of it was just that it turned out Hubbard was this fascinating character who was interested in a lot of the same things that I was getting interested in. And I began to read more about his work and found that I had a lot to learn from what he had done, even though he died 25 years ago and the bulk of his work was done even earlier than that. But I can tell you a little bit more about how I got interested in this topic in the first place. I was reporting on climate science for a number of years for places like Nature and Science, and I ran across this idea of peak oil, the idea that oil production might hit a peak at some point and then enter a long decline. And I hadn't heard people talking about this really at all. And I started to read more, and the people in the climate community just said that the problem is there's too much fossil fuels and we have to find ways of keeping them in the ground. But then when I read more, I realized that it's not the same for every fossil fuel. There's definitely a lot more coal than we can burn, but oil is more limited. And at that point, when I was starting to get interested in it in 2010, the price of oil had already spiked way up over $150 a barrel. And so it seemed that there were problems with supplying enough, even when the price had gone up a lot and companies had started investing a lot more in exploration and in drilling and so on. So it seemed to me like the story was more complicated than just that there's too much fossil fuels. And so I kept digging, and this guy Hubbard kept coming up. And when I read more about him, it turned out that he was this big picture thinker who was thinking not just about how to forecast the future of oil, but about the role of energy in society and the long-term fate of civilization. And so I thought, wow, this guy is really interesting, but there's no biography of him. I wanted to read one if there was one, but there wasn't. So I decided to try to write one myself.
And good thing you did. Now, listeners, you know that peak oil spawned a worldwide movement holding international conferences, and now it seems we're awash in oil, so the question is always, is this relevant? Is peak oil dead? And I promise we'll get into that later in the interview. But first, I'd really like to go, Mason, back to the 1950s when Hubbard first proposed the curve of peak oil. How could an American geologist know how much oil and gas the Earth might hold?
So, yeah, in the 1950s, Hubbard was working at Shell Oil at that time, and he was the head of research there on exploration and production of oil. So basically, he was one of the oil industry's top researchers. And he'd been following issues, oil issues, for a long time, even though most people in the industry weren't worried about whether the industry would be able to supply enough oil. Hubbard was worried about it, and we can get into that more later about how he came to be worried about it when others weren't. But when he looked at the estimates that existed at that time for how much oil would probably be available in the U.S. and then also in the whole world, he realized that production in the U.S. would probably reach a peak in the not-too-distant future because you wouldn't just be able to use up all the oil and then suddenly use the last barrel and then the production just stops at that point. Instead, it would go up to a peak and then it would get harder and harder to get enough oil and the production would decline over decades. And if it follows this kind of smooth curve that he's become famous for, then he said it looks like the peak for U.S. oil production would come a lot sooner than most had expected, based on generally well-accepted estimates of how much oil the nation would ultimately extract. But he pointed out that even if there was a fair amount more oil than what people were expecting at that time, that it still would not delay the peak all that much. So he was expecting that it would come around 1965 to 1970. And so he was saying this in 1956 was when he issued his first forecast along these lines. But nobody believed it, even though he was using numbers that, you know, estimates for oil that were well accepted. So as he put it once, I didn't come up with any new figures. I just showed them what the old figures meant. But as soon as he made this argument, people began coming up with much bigger estimates because they didn't like his conclusions. And it might not have been completely conscious that they thought, well, we just need to come up with bigger numbers in order to avoid this conclusion.
Yeah, you know, Saudi Arabia is doing that all the time. I mean, the whole Middle East, all of a sudden, they just bumped up their reserves tremendously without really explaining that they'd done any new discoveries.
Right. And then since they bumped it up, then they've held it constant for almost 30 years, where it's just not believable as a real number based on geology and economics.
Well, in a YouTube video that I found that's called Health Facilities and the Energy Crisis, where actually he says nothing about health facilities, but he really explains the theory pretty well. He shows a graphic of the past 5,000 years of human history with a little blip of less than 300 years, which is our times, our fossil fuel civilization. Talk to us about that blip, that little window in time that he saw.
Yeah, I mean, with this graph, which he showed in papers and talks over decades, he was really trying to get people to think about the long term, to realize how unusual the situation is that humanity is in right now, where we did not have this kind of energy at our disposal in centuries past. And now we've found various ways to extract all these fossil fuels and add a little bit more energy from other sources other than fossil fuels. But mostly it's been in fossil fuels that have been responsible for all this increase in energy that we have. And along with that, there's been a huge increase in the population on the planet and in the impact that we have on the planet, including climate change and deforestation and all sorts of other impacts that we're having. And a lot of times people would think about the short term and think of this kind of growth that we're going through as something normal and something that would just keep going indefinitely for the foreseeable future, people would often say. His general point was, let's try to foresee farther into the future. Let's not just say the foreseeable future is the next 5 or 10 years. Let's think about where we're going over 100 years or 1,000 years. So that's why he was presenting that kind of graph, to try to break people out of their normal thinking about the relatively short term.
Now, there is one other theory of oil production. I mean, Mason, Hubert said that oil came from plant material that just wasn't decayed properly and built up over a long period of time. And there's a whole theory of how that oil is made. But there is another theory out there, the abiotic theory of oil production, that somehow oil is very plentiful and produced by some action in the Earth's crust or something. Did you look into that?
I've read about it in the past. I don't know of anybody serious who's still promoting that idea, so I didn't spend very much time looking into it. I mean, there was the one Nobel Prize-winning physicist, I believe, Thomas Gold, who had argued for this idea, or at least that it should be tested. And my understanding is that the tests were done, and they showed that the abiotic idea was wrong. I'm not sure it's worth going into the details, but if anybody wants to look it up, they can search around for what Thomas Gold was saying and for the tests that tried to put his idea.
Right. I just wanted to knock that out as a fringe idea that you should avoid, because that isn't what happened. Anyway, let's dive back to the 1930s in New York for the formation of this man. King Hubbert became involved in both academia and industry even before he finished his Ph.D., and during the Great Depression, Hubbert was one of the prime founders of a theory and a movement called technocracy. Can you give us just a brief primer on technocracy? What's that?
Sure. So this was a movement that these scientists and engineers formed in the depths of the Great Depression because things were so bad, and the business leaders and politicians and so on didn't have a very good explanation of what had gone wrong and didn't have very good ideas about how to try to get things working again. And so in this void of ideas, Hubbert and some others began building this group that they called Technocracy. And it argued that the problem was that machines were putting people out of work and that society had not adjusted to that. And they didn't see this as a problem. They thought it was actually a good thing that machines could replace labor. And they thought we should keep developing machines to replace even more labor, but they also thought we should change society in order to share the products of all these machines equally between people. And they argued that everybody would be able to work relatively short hours and have enough to have a decent life. So people could work maybe 16 hours a week, and then they would have a lot of time left over for reading or playing music or whatever it is that they would want to do. That's not directly related to producing what we need to get by every day.
But we, who are all that are left of the old engineers and mechanics, have pledged ourselves to salvage the world. We have the airways, all that's left of them. We have the seas. And we have ideas in common. The brotherhood of efficiency. The Freemasonry of science. We're the last trustees of civilization when everything else has failed.
I've been waiting for this.
Well, I'm particularly interested in the technocracy idea to substitute energy certificates for money. Maybe this could be a solution to drive a reduction in emissions if we get paid in maybe carbon emission allowances. What was Hubbert proposing there?
Yeah, so this was an idea that came from the guy who's really the founder of technocracy, an engineer named Howard Scott. And then Hubbert helped him develop the idea a bit when they formed technocracy. And so the idea is that we need modern forms of energy like electricity from burning coal and things like that to power all the machines that we rely on for producing things in factories or for running farm equipment and so on. And so they thought that it would make more sense to have everything paid for in terms of the energy that it took to create it rather than using dollars, which don't have any real fixed value. They can just float in value depending on what is going on with the economy at that point. There can be inflation or deflation and so on. So they thought this would, using the energy certificates, would be a better way to manage society, and they would be able to keep things running smoothly so that they could produce enough goods without having these big booms and busts like the U.S. had gone through at that point. So the idea was probably naive in a lot of different ways, but it was still interesting to think about how could you change the monetary system and how we allocate goods between people and so on in order to try to basically make things better for everybody instead of just allowing whoever has the money to have more power.
So briefly, what happened to the technocracy movement? Did it die or is it alive today?
It is still around. The organization still exists. And I went to their headquarters, which is now in a small town called Ferndale in northern Washington, right near the Canadian border. And they still have all of their old papers and so on, which they were very gracious and let me go through, and which was really helpful for the research for the book. But there are very, very few members of the group anymore. So in all practical sense, they've pretty much died off. They haven't really put out much new literature over the years either. So Hubbert wrote a book called The Technocracy Study Course back in the mid-1930s. And that was a time when the movement was really booming. After Hubbert and others first put the idea out there, then they got a lot of media attention. People started forming these study groups spontaneously around the country. And so the organization Technocracy began trying to organize these groups, and Hubbert wrote this book in order to try to help people go through some of the fundamentals of how modern society works. And he talked about energy supplies and economic growth and all sorts of other issues that he thought was important for anybody to know if they really wanted to understand how things work.
And that's all the stuff they should be teaching right now in schools, I think.
Yeah, so, I mean, if they made an updated version of something along the lines of what he was doing, I think it could be really useful. And so Hubbert definitely was drawing on his experience as a teacher when he was writing it. And so at the time, he was a lecturer at Columbia University in geophysics, and he had started teaching on that topic even when he was still doing his graduate degree at the University of Chicago. And through his whole life, he always enjoyed teaching, and he thought education was really the key to trying to get people to think differently about energy and how we organize society and to try to come around to something that he considered more rational.
So in a podcast with Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity, you described Hubbert as stubborn, and maybe that's a prerequisite for an oracle who's going against the mainstream, even in his own industry. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there were a few other people who had somewhat similar forecasts to his, but they weren't as stubborn as he was. They didn't stick with it in saying, you know, here's the evidence that I have. I'm going to gather more evidence to try to convince you. I'm going to keep hammering away at this message and try and get people to take it seriously. And unfortunately, in the U.S., he still was not able to get people to take it seriously before the U.S. oil production hit a peak in 1970. But afterward, not immediately, but after several years, people did belatedly realize, oh, this is the thing that Hubbert had predicted. And I think it was helpful to have had his ideas out there beforehand so that people understood what was going on and that it was not some kind of conspiracy or something by the oil companies to just jack up the price of oil, that there were reasons why the U.S. was not able to produce as much as people in the country wanted and why they would need to cut back on their consumption and so on if they wanted to avoid being completely at the mercy of OPEC producers.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Mason Inman. He's the author of a new biography of M. King Hubbert, The Oracle of Oil, A Maverick Geologist's Quest for a Sustainable Future. What sort of guy was he? Was M. King Hubbert a family man?
No. he didn't have any kids, and he also was not that interested in spending time with his own family. He grew up on a farm in central Texas, one of the poorest parts of the country at that time. He was born there in 1903. And he was, you know, clearly brilliant from a young age and didn't have a lot in common with other people in his family. So he basically took off from Texas as soon as he could and went off to University of Chicago and was able to get into college there.
But he did, you know, come from oil country, and he went into the oil business. I guess he was a success. Do you think he would have driven a Cadillac?
He had a Mercedes at one point when he was older. But most of the time he drove a Chevy, which was, you know, a much cheaper car. And then he, when he got older and was close to retiring from Shell, if I remember right, then he splurged and bought a Mercedes when he was over in Germany on a lecture tour, and he had it shipped back to the U.S.
Later in life, say in the 1960s or 70s, did Hubbert find an acceptable political party given his early technocracy views?
So, yeah, I mean, I think he was always a bit frustrated with politics because he wanted to see things change a lot more and a lot faster than they did. But at the same time, he did support some politicians. He became friends with two brothers that were in politics, Stuart Udall and Mo Udall. And Stuart Udall was Secretary of Interior in the 60s, and then he and Hubbert became friends in the 70s. And I believe it was in 1976, Mo Udall, who was a U.S. senator, if I remember right, he ran for president. And he had a shot, even though he wasn't one of the leaders, and Hubbert, you know, contributed to his election funds and so on. So he was, you know, there were some politicians who he did support because he felt that they were starting to realize some of these issues about that, you know, we can't just have as much oil as we want forever. We can't just assume that economic growth is going to keep going on indefinitely, and that we should take measures to try to conserve energy and different things like this. But, you know, were small steps, but he thought that they were steps in the right direction.
And how did Hubbert's work relate to the Club of Rome report that was released in the 1970s called Limits to Growth? And did he influence that report?
It seems that he did have some influence on that report. That report was written by several researchers at MIT. And in going through Hubbard's papers, I found a letter from one of the researchers, Dennis Meadows. And he was writing to Hubbard before that report came out, but when I believe it was in the process of doing the analysis or the writing. And he suggested to Hubbard that they collaborate and said that their team had gotten inspiration from Hubbard. When I saw this letter, I thought that was really interesting, and I got a hold of Dennis Meadows and was able to talk to him about it. And he said they got inspiration from a lot of places, but Hubbard was one of the sources. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened if they had collaborated, but it never worked out, partly because Hubbard thought he was working for the U.S. Geological Survey at that time, and he thought it wasn't appropriate for him as a government researcher to be collaborating with them. But also, Hubbard was just not very good at collaborating with people in general. He had strong feelings about how work should be done, and it made it so that he was difficult to work with.
And you've also said that worries about peak oil rebounded in an unfortunate way in the Carter Doctrine of American military dominance of oil supplies in the Middle East. Did people in the Carter White House know about M. King Hubbard?
They did. The Secretary of Energy at that time, James Schlesinger, he knew about Hubbard's work, and when I interviewed him before he died, he said that he actually had planned to give Hubbard a national medal in order to highlight the work he had done and how he was raising important issues that the U.S. and the world needed to grapple with. But then Schlesinger was also a very stubborn, abrasive person like Hubbard, and Schlesinger wound up getting fired by Carter before he was able to give Hubbard this national medal, so that never happened. But yeah, Schlesinger had been in the Nixon and Ford administrations before the Carter administration as head of the CIA and as Secretary of Defense. And at that time, when the 1973 OPEC oil embargo began, he and Kissinger were talking about invading the Middle East, invading the United Arab Emirates, or I guess it was maybe before they were united, but they were talking about invading Abu Dhabi, which is right next to Saudi Arabia, and to send a message to Saudi Arabia and the other members of OPEC that they should not, you know, raise the price too much and exploit their position as holders of these huge reserves of relatively cheap oil. But they fortunately, in my view, did not ever follow through on those plans to invade. But these kind of ideas were bouncing around for a long time through the Nixon and Ford and Carter administrations, and then arguably into the Bush administrations, Bush Senior and Bush Junior. So that's one of the things I really worry about, is that if we do run into oil crunches, that there'll be a push to just try and seize oil from wherever it's available.
Okay, and how did Hubbard handle his growing fame as an older man, and how did he handle his senior years? I guess he passed away when, 1989?
Yeah. So he kept working up until the end as much as he could. He had some health problems, but his mind was still very much there. And in the early 80s, when Hubbard was a bit over 80 years old, he was still trying to see how he could improve his forecast. The approach that he had taken for forecasting world oil production, he knew was pretty rough. And he was trying to get better data so that he could try to improve those. And I think that says a lot about him, that he wasn't content to just put out a forecast and say, this is how it is. You know, he always wanted it to be based on the best possible data and wanted to keep doing the work as long as he could.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're going to move to the present and the future as we talk with Mason Inman, the author of a biography of M. King Hubbard called The Oracle of Oil, A Maverick Geologist's Quest for a Sustainable Future, and that's something we all want. I got a few questions now about our present situation in 2016. My first one is, why did Hubbard miss the whole fracking boom? Or did he?
To give a little bit of background, he was the one that first explained how fracking works back in the mid-1950s. So then people say, well, why didn't he see this coming? You know, he knew how fracking worked. So to be fair, basically nobody else was expecting that fracking would become so big in these particular kinds of rock formations that have turned out to be amenable to fracking. And so even, you know, in 2010, long after Hubbard died, most analysts were not expecting a big boom of production in the U.S. But Hubbard's forecasts for conventional oil production, not fracking shale, but the other sources where you drill a hole in the ground and oil comes out, his forecasts for that were actually very close to how things have turned out over many decades since he issued those forecasts. And I don't know of many forecasts over that kind of length of time that are as close as his forecasts. Oh, some people say, so then, you know, with fracking and other unconventional sources like tar sands, then it's just showed that Hubbard was completely wrong. But he knew that there were various unconventional sources that were generally more expensive, and that as it became harder to get enough conventional oil out of the ground, that people would turn to these other sources. So it's not that he didn't know that they existed or just thought that they would not contribute anything. I think people sometimes get carried away and they see how the oil production in the U.S. has risen really quickly, and they infer from that that it is going to be a huge contributor for a very long time. But I think those analyses are not very good a lot of the time, and we need to do better analyses to understand what the long-term fate of the production from fracking will be.
Well, and then as we talked about, the peak oil movement became international, and there were forums with speakers and all of that, and I've done quite a few radio programs about it. Lately, it's gone somewhat silent with some of its members morphing over into the movement on climate change. Is peak oil as a social movement just in hiatus? Will it return, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely died down a lot. A lot of people who were concerned about it before have gone kind of quiet, as you said. And I think part of it is a lot of people assumed that it would kind of lead to something more disastrous than has happened, and that things would play out somewhat smoothly where you would have a peak and then a decline would start and so on. But the reality has been messy, where we've had a plateau of conventional oil production over the last decade. The price of oil spiked way up. There was a global recession that was the worst in several decades that, you know, cut into how much people wanted to consume. And then now there's the fracking boom, and then the fracking bust. It's been a real roller coaster ride over the last 15 years or so. And it's difficult to tease out from all of that exactly where things are heading. But I think if you look at it carefully, then you can get a better idea of where things are going.
Sooner or later, we will run out. I mean, that curve is a for sure thing. We just don't know when, and that's, I think, what the debate is about. And meanwhile, though, the American author and professor Michael Clare says peak demand will come before peak oil ever develops. In an article in Common Dreams, he writes, according to the experts, and I may get this name wrong, Thies van de Graaff and Aviel Verbruggen, overall world peak demand could be reached as early as 2020. And I'm guessing from the article that that's due to a combination of uncertainty about fossil supply, climate-driven emissions regulations and costs, transition to other forms of energy. So my question for you, Mason Inman, what do you think about Clare's statement on peak demand? Would that change Hubbard's work?
Well, to put it in perspective, Hubbard was trying to get people to switch off of oil. He wasn't just saying oil production will decline and we're all doomed. He was saying we need to plan ahead to switch over to other things. And if we really planned ahead, then what would happen might be something much like what these peak demand people are talking about, where the price of oil would not skyrocket and we would be making a big effort in order to switch over to alternatives. And, you know, the transition away from oil would be relatively smooth. And so in that sense, if people really took Hubbard's forecast seriously, they could be sort of a self-defeating prophecy where if people looked back in 2050 or 2100, they go, oh, that Hubbard guy was worried about peak oil, but it was fine because we made this transition off of oil. It was no problem. But I don't think that, you know, is by any means inevitable that it'll play out that way. So a lot of times people talk about peak demand, but they don't really talk about prices. And to me, it's a bit strange when we've already had a big spike in oil prices where clearly, you know, the demand was running ahead of what could be supplied. And now we've had a crash in the price and people seem to treat it as though this is a new permanent state of affairs. And I don't think that it is. We can see that the oil companies are struggling financially with the price where it is. They're cutting back their spending on exploration production drastically. And that is going to lead to less oil production in the years to come. So there's starting to be more and more warnings from various people, you know, including the International Energy Agency, that these cutbacks that we're seeing now in investment in the oil industry could well come back to bite us in a few years down the road. And so it's far from clear to me that we are at the start of a smooth transition away from oil. We have a very, very long way to go. But if we did do that and we did make a smooth transition away, even if it was because people were more worried about climate change and not so worried about whether there would be enough oil in the decades to come, then I think that would be a good thing. But I, you know, wrote this book because I'm not sure that we really are going to make a smooth transition like that. And I'm worried that oil prices will spike up again, that we'll wind up spending a lot of money, hundreds of billions of dollars a year, on drilling wells and so on in order to keep our oil-fueled economy going while we try to make this transition away from oil. And this is money that we could be spending on getting off of oil instead of just trying to keep supplying enough oil to keep our cars running and so on right now.
And he was concerned about population. I mean, he says that the fossil fuel age is a short blip in human history and that when energy supplies begin to run out, we will not be able to support the current large population. To me, that means either a complete change in reproduction within a generation or so, or a die-off. What did Hubbard say about that?
Well, he was definitely concerned about population, and he encouraged people to not have too many kids. He and his wife had no kids, and he was a longtime supporter of birth control, so he was giving money to Planned Parenthood and other groups like that, in particular ones that would help poor women get access to birth control because they might not know what was available or might not easily have access. And he thought everyone should be able to control their births as they see fit. So he was definitely concerned about these things. He didn't talk about dire scenarios of die-offs or anything like that, but he did want people to change, you know, how many kids they have, how they consume energy, and so on, in order to try to avoid bad outcomes. And he was concerned that if we did not make these kind of transitions soon enough, that we would essentially run into a myriad of problems and civilization as we know it would sort of gradually fizzle out instead of continuing on for hundreds or even thousands of years.
Well, now, Hubbert promoted moving to different sources of energy, as you say, Mason Inman. Talk to us about his thoughts on nuclear energy.
So he was a big supporter of nuclear power starting in the 1950s. But then over the years, his views gradually changed, and eventually he came out as a strong opponent of nuclear power. And this had a lot to do with his involvement with the Atomic Energy Commission. So he was an advisor to them through this panel of the National Academy of Sciences that he was on, where they were advising on nuclear waste disposal, you know, how to try to take care of the waste that's produced in a safe way. And he did not like the Atomic Energy Commission. He thought that they were handling nuclear waste in a sloppy way and that they didn't want to be bothered with trying to do things properly. And so he never quite put it this way, but essentially he was, it seems that he thought it was a great technology, but that people weren't handling it well. He was also following other energy technology development, and he was skeptical about whether solar power would ever become big, but as the technology improved, he became a lot more enamored with solar power, and then finally in the early 70s, he said, you know, I've changed my mind, I've turned around 180 degrees, I used to be a big proponent of nuclear power, and now I think it's, you know, dangerous and not the way to go, and I think that we should be putting huge efforts into solar power. And he was not only talking about PV panels where they produce electricity from solar energy, but he was also arguing for trying to develop solar fuels where you use solar power in order to create liquid fuels that you could send through pipelines and so on. And I'm not sure that he thought that would be a solution forever, but that it could be useful to help keep some of the infrastructure running that we have and be able to use all the pipelines we have and work with the cars that we have and so on. But in general, he was trying to see what kind of energy sources would be able to keep running for the very long term, meaning hundreds of years at least. And so one of his big beefs with nuclear power was that people were developing these light water reactors, the kind that we have now. But they essentially burn uranium sort of like a fossil fuel. But if they had developed these breeder reactors, they would create more nuclear fuel as they ran and would be able to make much better use of the uranium that's in the ground and be able to keep running for a very long time. But there was not a lot of effort put into these breeders, so that was one another reason why he was not happy with how nuclear power had developed. So he, you know, turned to renewables because he said these are going to keep going indefinitely and we should be turning to those as our long-term sources of energy.
Well, oil still powers the world, and given the possibilities, I mean, all sorts of things could happen. We could have deindustrialization if it becomes scarce. We could have a depression worse than in the 1930s. He always thought that one was an artificial depression. So given these possibilities, do you think Hubbert was a pessimist or an optimist about the direction the future will really take?
I mean, it was a little bit of both. I mean, he was a pessimist in the sense that he didn't think that markets would just magically lead to all the technologies and so on that we would need in order to keep things running as people expected, and would not be able to keep growth of consumption and growth of populations and so on going indefinitely. So for that reason, a lot of people have seen him as kind of a doomer and a naysayer and so on. But on the other hand, he was always optimistic that people would be able to look at where we're heading and be able to change course and come up with a better way of running things that would be more rational, be more fair, and be really sustainable. And so that's what kept him going with the papers that he was writing and the talks that he gave and so on over decades, even when people were not really listening to what he was saying, because he was optimistic that eventually the message would get through to enough people that it would lead to change. Or at least, you know, he thought he had to try, because otherwise, you know, what's the other option? You just give up. So, you know, he kept hammering away at these ideas and trying to get people to take them seriously.
Mason, does your new book have a website, a Facebook page, or some other way people can follow you and get the book?
Yeah, it does have a website. It's just oracleofoil.com. Or if you just, you know, search around for that and my name, Mason Inman, then I'm sure you can find it. And the book's available through all major booksellers like Amazon and Apple iBooks and Barnes & Noble and whatever format you want. And if anyone wants to read a bit of the book before they buy it, if you go to my website and sign up for my mailing list, then I'll send you a free download of the epilogue of the book, which covers events since Hubbard's death and talks about where things might be heading. And then hopefully that will pique people's interest and they'll want to hear about how we got to that point and read the rest of the book.
We've been talking with the widely published science journalist Mason Inman about his pivotal new book, The Oracle of Oil, A Maverick Geologist's Quest for a Sustainable Future. Incredibly, it's the first full biography of one of the most influential people in recent history, the man who discovered peak oil, M. King Hubbard. I'll have more links to everything we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. And you can find out more at the book website, oracleofoil.com. Mason, thank you for this work and for telling us about it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith, your host on Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The gigantic and record-setting heat wave over India has started to break up as the monsoon rains begin to develop in the south. Last week, the heat moved from northwest India, including the Punjab, toward the northeastern Indian states. Is the 2016 heat wave in Pakistan and India a beginning example of what we can expect in a warming world? Here to help is Dr. Lisa Alexander, an extreme weather specialist and senior researcher at the Climate Change Research Institute at the University of New South Wales in Australia. Lisa, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex.
So what is your take on the record-breaking heat wave that swept over India in May 2016?
Well, I mean, India is certainly known for its unbearable conditions at this time of year and just before the monsoon, as you said, which has just started or beginning to start. But this has been a particularly hot season, and we have seen some record-breaking temperatures, especially up in the northwest of India. And it basically also comes on the back of a massive drought, which tends to exacerbate heatwave conditions, both intensity and duration. Add to this sort of the effects of aerosols that you get from wood-burning fuels that people burn in their home, and then obviously you have very unpleasant conditions. So certainly it's the type of thing we'd expect at this time of year, but obviously there have been some records broken.
Yes, it kind of went over the top. I know Australia had to add new heat zones to its maps a couple of years ago. Is this kind of extreme heat common, or is it becoming more common?
Well, I mean, there's certainly places in the world, obviously, that do experience temperatures that we've seen. And you've seen in India, we got up to 51 degrees Celsius. So obviously, incredibly hot temperatures. But we do see those sorts of temperatures in places, including Australia and the Middle East and North Africa, and even in Death Valley in the United States. So these types of temperatures do exist, and we do get them in the world, but certainly in the warming world that we have seen over the last decades, we're certainly starting to see more of these extreme temperatures.
So Lisa, you chair a World Meteorological Organization special team on climate risk. Does the WMO have special monitoring for extreme heat events?
Yes, they do, but obviously National Weather Services themselves, who sit under the WMO, monitor the weather and climate continuously, and that, of course, includes monitoring extreme events. So every country will have something in place for this monitoring, but WMO, on top of that, does have special task teams and special expert groups which do help with that monitoring, and they try and help especially developing countries help to prepare for those monitoring services.
So the drought extended to Vietnam, which is a major rice exporting nation normally. I'm wondering, could this kind of heat develop into crop loss in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, well, crops are definitely detrimentally affected by excess heat. And in fact, you know, certain crops just can't grow or will die if temperatures exceed very high thresholds. That's very crop dependent, however, so obviously the temperatures for rice will be very different from the temperatures for wheat, will be very different from the temperatures for soy. So basically, while there could be widespread crop loss, I mean, there are lots of different factors which could affect that.
Now, as Australians know too well, heat deaths increase when nighttime temperatures don't cool off enough. Why is that?
Well, I mean, your body needs a rest, and especially if it's exposed to very high temperatures. I mean, we have a physiological response to temperature. And basically, once our core body temperature exceeds a certain threshold, and in this case, it's, say, about 40 degrees Celsius, our organs actually begin to fail. And unless we can cool down straight away, you would die, essentially. So even for temperatures below that, and our core body temperatures are normally around the 37 degrees Celsius mark. So once we get above that, I mean, we'll start to experience heat stress and heat stroke and numerous other conditions that will affect our health. So at that point, if we do exceed, you know, our normal core body temperature, we do need to have some kind of mechanism to allow our bodies to cool down. Otherwise, we do get to the point where we do get into very serious health issues.
And it also seems that humans can take a day or two of extreme heat, but adding just one or two more days can create a public health emergency. Is that a function of the way society works, do you think, or is it based on human physiology?
Yeah, well, as I said before, definitely there is a physiological response here. And if we don't have the capacity to let our bodies rest and cool down, then obviously we can if we keep adding an extra day of excess heat. And especially if we don't get the ability to cool down at night, then it does definitely cause a public health emergency, as you said.
And do you have ideas on what governments or NGOs in developing countries could do to help their populations survive extreme heat?
Obviously, one thing is better forecasting of these events. And actually, I think, to be fair, that the National Weather Services in most countries do a very good job of that. But obviously, actually, the forecast in itself is not the be-all and end-all. And actually, even if you have a good forecast, you then have to put measures in place to actually be able to prepare and respond to that forecast. So definitely, as well as better forecasting, we need better preparation and various measures put in place, especially to look after the people who are most vulnerable to this extreme heat, and that would be the extremely young and the extremely old.
I've been looking into a new study, Lisa, published in the journal Climatic Change. The title is Benefits of Mitigation for Future Heat Extremes. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, that's the Tibaldi and Wehner paper.
Yes.
From Climatic Change. Yes, I am. So that paper, it's really telling us that very extreme temperatures scale with the strength of our emissions. And that is essentially that the more fossil fuels we burn, the hottest temperature is going to be. So it seems that if we only consider mitigation and not adaptation measures, then we could reduce those most extreme hot days by reducing the amount of greenhouse gas accumulation in the atmosphere.
Do you know what sort of heat we can expect if the world continues to depend mainly on fossil fuels well past 2050?
Well, we can certainly continue to expect the sorts of temperatures that we've seen, and you know, what we might call extreme today could essentially become the norm in the future. So, I mean, this is obviously quite worrying when we're getting by 2050 in a lot of locations what we consider extreme to be the sort of everyday types of temperatures that we might expect in summer, for example. So we really have to prepare for those kinds of temperatures in the future if we do nothing at this point in terms of curbing our greenhouse gas emissions.
You know, it's interesting. I looked at a survey of media coverage about this Indian heat wave, and apparently very few Western sources, including the BBC or CNN, mentioned climate change at all. Indian newspapers did. Indian politicians talked about the climate connection. What happened in Australia, or did this Indian heat wave even make much of an impact on Australian media?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously I've seen quite a lot of media about it, but then I'm obviously interested in heat waves and in general. So I would say it didn't make the top story, but certainly, as I said before, I mean, in India at this time of year, I mean, these are the sorts of, you know, you do have to expect that you would get very high temperatures. So perhaps it hasn't really come into the Western media for that reason. But as I said earlier, we are warming the climate, and we can expect that the temperatures we're seeing in India, while we would expect them to be high, are probably being made even higher by human influence.
Lisa Alexander, what sort of work do you do?
Well, primarily these days, so mostly I'm a researcher and a lecturer at a university, and I look primarily at changes in extreme weather and climate events, and that includes things like heat waves, heavy rainfall, and sort of extratropical cyclones. So I basically try and understand how these events have varied in the past, and I try and look at how these events might be affected in the future under various scenarios of how we might affect the climate.
And does the data support the idea that we're getting more extreme events, or is it just better reporting?
Well, I'm sure the reporting is much better these days, but definitely the data do support that we are getting more extreme temperatures. And actually, in India, for example, which is the place we've been talking about, we have seen very significant increasing trends in the frequency of heat waves that we've seen over the last 60 years or so over India. Actually, not so much in the intensity of the heat waves, so like the hottest temperature of the heat waves, we haven't seen much of a trend there, but we have seen a lot of change in the frequency. So the data do support increases in extreme temperatures in most regions of the world. Actually, one region where the temperatures actually aren't getting warmer is in the southeast US, and we call that the warming hole. So there's basically a few places in the world where we're not seeing extreme temperatures increasing, but on the whole, pretty much everywhere apart from a few locations, we are seeing warming.
As we wrap up here, is there anything that I've missed or something else that you would like to tell our listeners?
I mean, I guess just very simply, we are seeing increases in temperature extremes across most places in the planet. And we can't explain the changes that we've seen unless we include increases in greenhouse gases from human activity. And if we do nothing now, those temperature extremes will continue to rise. So, you know, I guess that's the sort of simple message that I would like your listeners to take away.
It's really going to be a less pleasant world if we let this go.
Honestly, I think so, yes.
Yeah. We've been speaking with climate and weather expert Dr. Lisa Alexander. She's a senior researcher at the Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales, Australia. Lisa also participates widely in international groups dealing with extreme weather under climate change. Thank you so much for helping us out on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Behind the scenes of Radio EcoShock, links to last week's program on the Indian and Pakistani heat waves were tweeted to over 100,000 people in 3 days. That's because we had three high-powered guests. It turns out Berkeley Lab, where we recruited the expertise of Dr. Michael Wehner, has over 40,000 Twitter followers. So does the Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies, where EcoShock guest Adil Najam is the dean. Our scientist from India was just appointed as Secretary of the Ministry of Earth Sciences for the Government of India. That's a huge responsibility of care for over 1 billion people. Add it up, and a lot of new people heard about Radio EcoShock last week. The retweets were just as enlightening. Scientists, professors, students, professionals from many walks of life found the show worth sharing with their friends. This week I'm asking you to do the same. If you find this program worthwhile, please tell all your connections through a tweet, a Facebook post, on your blog, or whatever media you use. I think Radio EcoShock has a role to play, by getting the research and expertise directly from the sources straight to you. If you know how to use social media, please share Radio EcoShock widely. It may not be popular with everyone, but sooner or later, flood by fire, by storms and by heat, by invasion of the seas and tropical bugs, everyone will need to understand what we cover on this program every week. Thank you for letting me be useful, for giving me the chance to help us all learn, feel, and be together. I'm Alex Smith. Please join us again next week as we explore this changing world on Radio EcoShock. Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org.
Logistical, political, and social order of the United States was built on slavery. From the beginning, colonizers took hostages and reduced them to property and subjected them to forced labor. Later on, the practice of chattel slavery was confined to the southern states and abolished in the northern states, but its continued practice greatly lowered the cost of production for food and textiles. As a consequence of this lower cost of living, citizens of the U.S. lived well and lived cheap. All this spare time led to privileged white people dreaming up great stuff. Privileged white people with the luxury of sitting around and sipping lemonade and dreaming up stuff. So that's how we got the steam engine and the cotton gin, the telegraph and the telephone. During the period of southern slavery, while black slaves did all the work, privileged whites changed the whole world with innovations that made the United States first in everything. So really, everything the United States is, and everything it became, it owes to those who were sweating and bleeding and dying to keep the whole system going. Then, according to our national mythology, the Civil War was fought to end slavery. By that narrative, the abolitionist North fought the slave-owning South in order to free the slaves and end the immoral practice of reducing humans to chattel. That's a big fat lie, of course. Northern industrialists didn't want to end slavery, and second, slavery didn't end. The whole narrative is false. So look, Northern industrialists and Southern agriculturalists didn't fight over the existence of slavery, but over what form it would take. In the South, plantation owners employed the process of chattel slavery, owning and shackling humans for labor. In the North, industrialists employed the process of wage slavery, forcing humans under threat of starvation to perform labor. If you don't work, you don't eat. The difference was the wage slave had a few more privileges and could accumulate a bit more property, and he could conceivably go home to his own place for a few hours each day. But generally, workers in the coal mines or meatpacking plants or the steel mills were just as effectively owned as the chattel slaves in the South. Miners and meatpackers and stealers were just as dependent on the owners and just as subject to their whims as chattel slaves were to the plantation bosses. We don't think of wage slavery as slavery, so it's easy to sell us on the idea that the Northern industrialists cared so much about the wretched conditions of the oppressed blacks that they pushed the United States into a bloody, devastating war. But the truth is, we had two groups of privileged elites who were battling each other over the question of whose vision, whose idea of slavery and production should hold sway. Because the North won and the program of wage slavery prevailed, we are indoctrinated to think that we abolished the immoral practice of slavery.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
However, I would suggest to you that if the Southern chattel slavery program had won, our history books would recount a barbaric time when industrial elitists forced all of us into lives of drudgery before the universal application of the chattel slave system revolutionized our world and liberated us from work. To be clear, I'm not trying to advocate one form of slavery or another. The fact of the matter is, both of them suck. In both, you have a privileged elite at the top of the pyramid scheme to impose a brutal and detestable program upon everyone else. All forms of slavery are inimical to our natural impulse to freedom, to our inclination for autonomy and self-direction. All forms of slavery arise out of a pathology in thinking that there can be and should be master and slave, a state where many should serve the ruling few. Having said that, slavery still exists. Wage slavery is ubiquitous, a global form of simultaneous social control and mass production that reduces everyone to the role of labor generators that keep the entire program rolling on indefinitely to our own detriment. Wage slavery continues despite our abolitionist and egalitarian mythology to the contrary. It's time for a slave revolt, a global one. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance. What you say, what you say, what you say, what? Let's return to the topic of slavery from a previous segment. We have this cultural mythology in the U.S. that the Civil War abolished slavery. As previously presented, this abolition didn't include the end of wage slavery that continues today. But apart from that, it also really didn't end the practice of chattel slavery that was employed in the southern states by plantation owners. At the end of the Civil War, the 13th Amendment was ratified. Contrary to our cultural narrative, this amendment did not abolish slavery. Here's what the 13th Amendment says. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for a crime, whereof the party shall be duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Now, I want to read that one more time with an emphasis on what I think are the important points. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for a crime, whereof the party shall be duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. A reading of the 13th Amendment makes clear that the United States did not abolish slavery. What they did, they took the right to own slaves away from the private sector and monopolized the right to reduce citizens to slaves exclusively to the state, the government. From the time of the ratification of the 13th Amendment until today, the process for stripping people of citizenship and reducing them to slaves is under the operation of government courts. If a court employs its processes and determines you have committed a crime, that determination has the legal power to transform you into a slave. And again, just to clarify, it's irrelevant if you committed a crime or not. The 13th Amendment says nothing about whether you committed a crime. All that has to happen is that the government's courts declare that you did. Upon such a decree, you're a slave. Now, this is important to consider for purposes of understanding the legal ramifications of this. That, in one analysis, you're dealing with the cosmic and magical transformation of what used to be a citizen into a slave. But also consider that at the same time, you're dealing with the legal transformation of a person into property. Keep in mind, in American legalese, personhood is a legal definition. Remember, in court cases, slaves were defined as being a certain fraction of a person, like 3/5 or something. Someone of the status as a slave is no longer a person under the law, but is instead chattel or property. So under authority of the 13th Amendment, when a judge thumps a gavel and finds you guilty of a crime, the court is turning you from a citizen to a slave and from a person into property. You are owned by the state. You become little more than a coffee table or a lampstand, a piece of furniture to be moved and used and disposed of as the state sees fit. If we view the justice and corrections process through this legal lens, we see the true designs of the entire framework. Criminal courts are slave factories. They turn citizens into slaves, people into property, and so-called corrections facilities are really modern-day plantations. Through this lens, we see why prisoners have no rights. Prisoners are slaves, not citizens. Property, not people. In the view of the hierarchs and their legal framework, as prisoners, we cease to exist as human beings. We are chattel, like cows or sheep.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
Ironic, but when I figured that out, it suddenly made sense that when you seek to challenge confinement through remedies like habeas corpus, you file a suit against the warden. the same way a slave would challenge enslavement through a writ filed against the slave's owner. In the here and now, the prison is the plantation, the warden is the slave owner, and the prisoners are slaves. Taken together, this means all of us are confronted by a sprawling slaveocracy, one where each of us is facing the constant precarity of being permanently stripped of our own personhood and reduced to chattel by an ever-growing, ever-centralizing control state, actively rolling back even the illusion of protections it once may have offered. The United States is consciously and deliberately in the slavery business. I can think of no better argument for its non-existence. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance. What you say, what you say, what you say, what? Come like a bomb! A quick recap here. I've been stuck on the topic of slavery, starting with the chattel slavery of the Civil War and the program of wage slavery that dominated since then, and then moving on to the delusional hierarchy legal concept of slavery that's still imposed in the United States and used as the legal justification for the roughly 3 million people locked up in cages by the government. So if you had something better to do for the last couple of weeks rather than listen to my segments, and I can't even imagine what could possibly constitute something better to do, I would recommend you check those out. As a matter of fact, you should binge listen to all of my previous segments and then go out and tip over cop cars, but I digress. Slavery. Let's approach the topic from a somewhat opposite angle. The defining element of slavery is its non-freedom. That is, slavery is slavery as a consequence of the absence of freedom. Slavery and freedom are opposing states. So let me ramble a minute about slavery by talking about the thing it is not. A long time ago, I talked about how I define freedom, a definition I sort of plagiarized from Ward Churchill, a hero of mine. And that definition goes something like this. Freedom is the absence of external regulation. The idea, of course, is that where something is externally regulating you, you're not free. You're only free in the absence of external regulation. Where you are regulated, you are not free. Where you are free, you are not regulated. So picture in your mind a point, a dot, and that represents freedom, the absence of external regulation. Imagine another point, its opposite, that represents the complete absence of freedom, the ever-presence of external regulation. If we connect those two points with a line, we have a spectrum between absolute freedom at one point and the absolute absence of freedom at the other. I know, I've got the best graphics in radio. Only one political philosophy, by the way, advocates for absolute freedom in the absence of external regulation. Know what it is? Yep. Only anarchists advocate for the complete absence of external regulation, for absolute freedom. Every other system of thought is somewhere on that spectrum. Now let's return to the original topic. In the context of our spectrum and this working definition of freedom, what is slavery? Well, if slavery is a state of non-freedom, slavery exists everywhere except on that one absolute point where freedom exists. Every single point on the entire spectrum is some varying degree of non-freedom, some varying degree of external regulation. So, every single point on the spectrum, except for absolute freedom, the dot where all of us anarchists stand, is slavery, non-freedom. Let's not forget you're either free or you're a slave. So it's either an existence on the absolute point of freedom, the absence of external regulation, or it's slavery. Those are the only two states we can be in. We're either free or we're not. You can't be sort of kind of free any more than you can be sort of kind of pregnant. Freedom is an absolute. You are or you ain't. Freedom, the absence of external regulation, an absolute state, can only be attained by anarchists. No one else strives for it or values it or seeks it. They simply seek some kinder, gentler, more accommodating state of slavery, defined by life under external regulation. I'm not simply saying that, by this analysis, all hierarchs are slaves, although they are, and chain-hugging slaves at that, striving to maintain systems of non-freedom at all costs. But all hierarchies are slavery programs, programs of non-freedom. In fact, the vast majority of hierarchs offered freedom would not just decline, but would run away from it, would be utterly bewildered by the idea of living without external regulation. They absolutely love their varying degrees of slavery and worship the slavery program just so long as they have the illusions of freedom, the idea that they're free. Free, a word with absolutely no meaning or substance unless the words buy one, get one come before it. You're either free or you're a slave. If you're a slave, there's only one way to get free. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional, Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Perry, editor of ConsortiumNews.com, who examines Hillary Clinton's embrace of Republican neoconservative supporters in her campaign to win the White House. Professor Michael Hendricks, who talks about the launch of a National Academy of Sciences study into the health impacts of mountaintop removal coal mining, building on his previous research. And Brian Tashman of People for the American Way, who discusses GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump and Senator Marco Rubio's troubling attendance of an Orlando, Florida event sponsored by anti-LGBTQ extremists. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A significant number of the refugees relocated to an Australian detention camp on the Pacific island of Nauru are victims of assault, sexual, and child abuse, according to a leaked cache of 2,000 incident reports revealed by former Save the Children staffers. Over half of the abuse incidents involved children, who make up only 20% of detention camp residents. The Guardian newspaper, which published the 2,000 incident documents, reported that some of the alleged abuse incidents were perpetrated by security guards. Now the Australian Medical Association has called for an independent inquiry to assess the mental health and living conditions of detainees held at Australia's two offshore detention centers. The centers were established for asylum seekers apprehended at sea as they attempted to enter Australia. Anna Neistat, a senior researcher with Amnesty International, protested that Australia's policy of exiling asylum seekers who arrive by boat is cruel in the extreme. Few other countries go to such lengths to deliberately inflict suffering on people seeking safety and freedom. Amid a global shift in refugee flows, Afghans who fled their nation's war and escaped to Turkey now feel forgotten and discriminated against in their quest to reach safety in the West because of an imperfect asylum system that fast-tracks those fleeing the most urgent, headline-grabbing war. Syrians and Iraqis, who formed the bulk of the stampede of more than 1 million migrants arriving in Europe in 2015, now take priority. In 2013, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees suspended Afghan asylum claims due to a large backlog of cases. Yet from 2013 to 2015, Afghans only accounted for 4% of all asylum cases approved in Turkey. Meanwhile, the Turkish government established a special rule to handle the influx of 2.7 million Syrian refugees who are able to get assistance and authorized to receive work permits. 2 years ago, Afghan refugees led a 52-day protest by setting up an encampment in front of the UN Refugee Office in Ankara, Turkey. A dozen sewed their lips together and launched a hunger strike, declaring that UN incompetence had deprived them of their fundamental rights. Civilian deaths are now rapidly on the rise in Afghanistan. Still, there is little chance most Afghan refugees can reach Europe, despite the fact that over 175,000 Afghans have filed asylum petitions. The U.S. Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation into the police killing of a Navajo woman, L'Oreal St. John, in Winslow, Arizona. Body camera video shows police officer Austin Shipley trying to restrain St. John, who was suspected of shoplifting, and pushing her to the ground. Moments later, St. John brandished a small pair of medical scissors, and Shipley shot the 27-year-old Native woman 5 times. In July, Officer Shipley was cleared of any wrongdoing by Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery, who reviewed the case. In response, St. John's family has filed a $10.5 million lawsuit against the city of Winslow. The suit claims Shipley violated the woman's civil rights, and the city ignored Officer Shipley's history of unwarranted aggressive actions while on the job. According to the Guardian newspaper's database of U.S. police killings, there has been a spike of police shootings of Native Americans over the last year. Thus far in 2016, 13 Native Americans have been killed by police. Simon Moya Smith, an Oglala Lakota Native activist, complained it's unfortunate that Native Americans are routinely excluded from this conversation about police killings. We first need to get the cops to see us as human, and hopefully then they won't see themselves as judges, the jury, and executioner. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After weeks of multiple gaffes and a continuing string of offensive statements, Donald Trump is fading in public opinion polls. Hillary Clinton, despite her own controversies, has been the beneficiary, with voter surveys finding that she's widening her lead in key battleground states and among many demographic groups. Trump's provocative positions have also had the effect of triggering disaffection among many Republicans. While a growing number of big-name Republicans have refused to support Trump, many have also taken the additional step of pledging their support to Clinton. Among that group are prominent neoconservatives, who generally advocate the promotion of U.S. interests as they see it through the use of military force. Clinton's neocon supporters include Robert Kagan, co-founder of the neocon think tank Project for the New American Century, that advocated for the Bush administration's decision to unilaterally invade Iraq in 2003. Others include Bush Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, former GOP National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, self-declared American imperialist Max Boot, and John Negroponte, Reagan's ambassador to Honduras and Bush ambassador to Iraq, who served as the first director of national intelligence 2005 to 2007. When Hillary Clinton bragged about the praise she received from President Nixon's Secretary of State Henry Kissinger during the February 4th Democratic presidential debate, her then opponent, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, responded by saying that he was proud to say that Henry Kissinger was not his friend and that he would reject advice from Kissinger. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Robert Perry, editor of ConsortiumNews.com, who examines Hillary Clinton's embrace of neoconservative supporters and what it may predict about her administration's foreign policy if she should win the presidency this November.
Hillary Clinton, who has had a long history as a very hawkish politician, supporting the Iraq War, not just in 2002 when she voted for it, but really until about 2006 when it became a huge burden on her political ambitions if she wanted to run against and get the Democratic nomination in 2008. So she only really dropped her support for the Iraq War because of political needs. It wasn't as much that she felt it was wrong, and she later, according to Secretary of Defense Gates in his memoir, she even told President Obama in 2009 that the only reason that she and others opposed the so-called surge in Iraq was for political reasons. She's taken these very hawkish positions, both before she ran for president and then as Secretary of State, she adopted many of the more aggressive positions, often going against President Obama, who was more reluctant to expand or to continue some of these military adventures. She sided often with the hawks inside his administration. She opposed him really on his efforts in even 2010 to work out a deal with the Iranians on their nuclear program. Obama had reached out to the president of Brazil and the prime minister of Turkey to have them essentially arrange for the Iranians to surrender much of their nuclear enriched uranium. And it was Hillary Clinton who sabotaged that arrangement. She was again taking the side of the neocons who wanted to bomb Iran, or at least continue to escalate those tensions. So she's had this position. She also joined with the hawks in 2009, pushing Obama into escalating the Afghan war, which Obama was very hesitant to do. He initially raised some of the troop levels when he came in, but then was hesitant to go to a counterinsurgency program, which she supported, along with General Petraeus and Defense Secretary Gates, to sort of essentially holdovers from the Bush years. So she continuously took these hawkish stances, and that has won her the support of many key neocons, and some of whom have abandoned the Republican Party, people like Robert Kagan, who was one of the co-founders of the Project for the New American Century, pushing for the invasion of Iraq even in the 1990s, and then continuing on into when it finally happened under President George W. Bush. So she's won their support because they feel that of the various choices, she is the best vessel, as it was put in one New York Times article, the best vessel to carry their ambitions forward.
From Hillary Clinton's record in the U.S. Senate and as Secretary of State under President Obama, what are some of your big concerns about what foreign policy a Clinton presidency might pursue?
Well, she indicated during the last debate with Senator Sanders, it's probably the best time to look at what she was staking out for her foreign policy, and it was very aggressive, it was very hawkish. It was neoconservative. For instance, her position on Libya has remained very hawkish. Her position regarding Syria is to intervene more directly militarily. Her position vis-a-vis the Palestinians is to take a very staunch pro-Israeli position, regardless of what the Israelis are up to. Regarding the Russians, she has indicated a willingness to be much more aggressive vis-a-vis President Putin. So she's taken hawkish positions, and she hasn't indicated that she's modified them. So But one has to assume that they still are her positions.
It's been the track record of the U.S. peace movement after recent presidential elections where Democrats won the White House that peace activists generally have gone to sleep. They've gone into a deep, deep coma and not come out of the woodwork to protest or, you know, pressure the government in any way on their foreign policy choices. We've seen that under Bill Clinton, and we certainly have seen that under President Obama. What's the outlook for the peace movement if you have a hawkish President Hillary Clinton in office?
Well, it's a good question, Scott. One thing I have written about is the potential for the Democratic Party to splinter, because you had the experience of the late 1960s, early 1970s, when there was a stronger peace movement, and over the Vietnam War, and there was a break within the Democratic Party over whether to support a more peaceful approach to that as some kind of negotiated settlement, or to continue the warfare. So I think there's a danger here that if Hillary Clinton does win the presidency and she does carry out a sort of neoconservative foreign policy, what will the peace element of the Democratic Party do? Will it continue to kind of, as you say, soft pedal these complaints, concerns, and try to make excuses for the Democrats if they expand or perpetuate these war policies? It's hard to say because obviously we don't know what the future holds. But that is a potential danger for the Democratic Party if Hillary Clinton governs along the lines of what she has advocated in terms of foreign policy.
That was investigative journalist Robert Perry, editor at ConsortiumNews.com. Find links to recent articles on Hillary Clinton's embrace of neoconservative supporters by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. It was recently announced that the National Academy of Sciences will undertake a study of the health impacts of surface coal mining in West Virginia, with a focus on mountaintop removal, in which the tops of mountain ridges are blasted off to extract the coal seams beneath. Residents of communities near mountaintop removal mining sites have long complained about air and water pollution, resulting, they say, in severe health impacts, such as increased risk of cancer, birth defects, and premature death. Area citizens have been organizing support for a federal law called the Appalachia Community Health Emergency Act, or AHCE Act, which would end the permitting of new mountaintop removal sites until thorough health studies could be conducted to provide evidence that the mining practice doesn't threaten public health. The request for the National Academy of Sciences study was made by West Virginia's longtime Secretary of Environmental Protection, Randy Huffman, whom activists had considered hostile to their concerns, and the relatively new state public health commissioner, Rahul Gupta, who had a reputation as a defender of public health. Their request was based largely on research by Professor Michael Hendricks, who conducted health studies for years while at West Virginia University. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Hendricks, now a professor in the Department of Applied Health Science in the School of Public Health at Indiana University, about the work he's done to highlight the health risks of mountaintop removal coal mining and what he hopes a new study will accomplish.
It is kind of a long trail of research. It started with some fairly relatively simple kind of quick and easy secondary data analyses that we could do with available databases that we had. So we just looked at associations between where people were living, some of them in mining environments and some not, and health outcomes that sometimes were based on self-reported health surveys, sometimes on mortality data from the CDC, and finding those kinds of associations. We could control for other variables as well as we could, so we could control statistically for things like age and smoking and poverty and a bunch of other kind of usual suspects, so to speak.
The CDC, that's the Centers for Disease Control.
And they have publicly available mortality data that we've used as one of our data sources to look at relationships between mortality rates and mining. So several of the studies looked at that, and we found higher mortality rates for some types of illnesses, like some types of cancer, including lung cancer, and for chronic forms of heart disease and lung disease, kidney disease. We started with those kinds of associational studies. And then more recently, we've been moving into trying to understand more directly what's really happening in the environment, what are the environmental conditions in these mining communities, and what are the potential health consequences of exposure to what's in the environments. So we've collected some air sampling, water sampling, and we've published papers that have shown that the levels of dust or particulate matter in the air are higher in the mining communities compared to control sites. We've shown that the chemical composition of this dust is pretty complicated. It probably comes from a variety of direct mining constituents as well as some of the indirect effects from the industrial activity. But it is high, among other things, it's high in silica. Silica is known to be a lung carcinogen and to promote the development of lung disease. And that is one of the most consistent health effects that we've seen. Lung cancer, COPD, other chronic forms of respiratory disease are clearly elevated in these communities. If you just take one study or another study in isolation, any one study by itself is not necessarily that powerful or convincing. But when you look across the body of evidence, you get, a very powerful pattern that shows that there are really health problems in these communities that are not because of poverty or smoking or obesity or age or the other things that the mining industry sometimes tries to blame it on, that we have solid evidence that the environmental conditions really are impaired in these communities compared to control communities, and that there are effects on biological tissues related to what is in these environments. We don't have a single definitive study that links mining activity to what gets into humans and to the health consequences for those same people. That type of definitive single study is very expensive to do, very time-consuming. You know, I haven't had the resources to try to do it. See, we have to always have a little bit of doubt and introduce a caveat here and there, but I think when you look at the entire body of evidence that it's pretty strong, that this activity is harmful to human health, it is harmful to community health for the people that live in these environments, and even if we don't understand all of the exact biological mechanisms or all of the exact exposures that people face, to try to say, well, we don't know enough, I think is irresponsible at this point and immoral, and that appropriate steps should be taken to eliminate mountaintop removal. I think the evidence not only for its public health harm but for its environmental harm are too strong to ignore, and that this form of mining should be stopped.
Professor Michael Hendricks, what impact do you think the Organizing for the Appalachian Community Health Emergency, or AIC Act, had on this development?
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, I'm just guessing based on my observations and what I've seen. But yeah, I think some of the activist efforts have been pretty visible, pretty vocal. The AIC Act is one good example of that, and other community protests that have taken place.
In your opinion, does this request for a study represent a change in attitude by officials in West Virginia about whether this is a problem or not?
Potentially. You know, I'm not going to draw any conclusions yet until I see exactly what they're asked to do, because I haven't seen the language of what they want that review to be. I don't know who exactly is going to be on the review panel. And even though it's the National Academy of Science, which has a great reputation, I want to just wait and see who the individuals are who are involved in it. But with those caveats, I am cautiously optimistic that this is a change in attitude and that maybe they're going to start to take this more seriously.
That was Michael Hendricks, professor at Indiana University's Department of Applied Health Science in the School of Public Health. Learn more about the research into the health impacts of mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 11th, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump and Florida GOP Senator Marco Rubio attended an event sponsored by the group American Renewal Project that featured some of the nation's most extreme anti-gay conservative Christian activists. The event, titled Rediscovering God in America, took place in Orlando, Florida, on the eve of the second-month anniversary of the Pulse LGBT nightclub massacre, where a lone gunman shot and killed 49 people and wounded 53 others. Speakers at this gathering have declared that AIDS is a God-given punishment against homosexuality, compared gay activists to terrorists, and warned that marriage equality threatened the utter destruction of our nation. The organizer of the Orlando event, David Lane, was quoted as saying in 2013 that God would punish America over the appearance of a gay poet and a pro-gay rights priest at President Obama's January 2013 inauguration. Your reporter spoke with People for the American Way's senior research analyst Brian Tashman, who discusses the Republican Party's ongoing culture war battle against gay rights and the disturbing message sent by Trump and Rubio's attendants at this anti-LGBT Orlando event.
Rediscovering God in America is an event that we've seen held in a number of states, typically swing states or early primary states, where an activist by the name of David Lane, he's not a pastor, he's a political operative, organizes meetings between pastors and candidates for office. So we have seen people like Mike Huckabee, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio, actually, during the presidential race, attend these events. And this Orlando event was organized and happened to coincide with exactly 2 months after the Pulse nightclub shooting. It was organized as well by David Lane, who told Bloomberg News that this would be a good opportunity for the candidates to talk about the threat of, in his words, homosexual totalitarianism. So he really wanted Donald Trump to speak about the supposed threat the LGBT rights movement presents to American freedoms. Other speakers at the event include Matthew Staver, who became very well known when he represented Kentucky clerk Kim Davis, and he actually criticized the Orlando nightclub attack memorials because he called them homosexual love fests. He is somebody who claims that gay people are actually demonic, akin to terrorists and pedophiles. He also believes that President Obama is trying to have forced homosexuality, in Matt Staver's words. Another speaker goes by the name of Ken Graves, who claims that militant homofascism, again, his quote, is working to create a secular humanist caliphate here in America. So we see some very radical activists attending this event alongside Donald Trump and Marco Rubio. And what they really want to do is keep the Republican Party close to the religious right in their agenda, whether it's opposition to abortion rights or continued hostility to LGBT equality.
Brian, suss out for us, if you would, Donald Trump's views as he's articulated it since the primary campaign and now in the general election campaign on gay rights. There's been some portrayal of him, especially during his remarks and his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, that he's somehow more moderate than a lot of people within the Republican Party. But there were very extreme statements within the Republican Party platform that took quite a different view of gay rights.
Absolutely. As you pointed out quite correctly, the Republican Party platform is the most conservative they've ever adopted, even more conservative than the one they adopted 4 years ago, which the platform committee members hailed at the time as the most conservative. It included one plank which subtly criticized laws which prevent parents from taking children to ex-gay therapists. That was among one of many other ultra-conservative planks in the platform. And Donald Trump is often portrayed as a moderate on social issues, mainly because he's waffled so much on them. He said abortion rights are okay, and then he said he was against them, then he said we shouldn't change the abortion rights laws, then he said he wants to ban it again. On gay rights, he's attended same-sex couples' weddings, he has expressed some openness towards marriage, but at the end of the day, what he says doesn't so much matter than the policies he takes. You know, we talk about the evolution, the majority of Americans are becoming more open-minded to gay rights. Donald Trump is the rare person who's actually moving far to the right. Originally, he criticized North Carolina's anti-LGBT HB2 law, and now he says he supports North Carolina's HB2 law. He originally criticized Kim Davis, the clerk who refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples following the Supreme Court Obergefell ruling, and now he says that he supports individuals who are trying to defy the Supreme Court. the best example of why Donald Trump would be a president hostile to LGBT rights would be his appointments to the federal judiciary. He has pledged to outsource the entire judicial nominating process to two groups, the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society. These are two of the most conservative groups in Washington, D.C. He will be handing over all of his judicial appointments to these far-right anti-gay organizations. And as we've learned, whether on marriage equality, on so many other social issues, a lot of these battles are decided in the courts.
That was People for the American Way's senior research analyst, Brian Tashman. Learn more about the Republican Party's alliance with religious extremists opposing gay rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Happy birthday to Sonny Driver, publisher of Scoop USA, a weekly community newspaper in Philadelphia that serves the community of Philadelphia, Chester, Camden, and Wilmington, Delaware, with style and distinction. In this little paper, people see their local sports heroes, local rappers, educators, and politicians. The daily papers report on us when we get arrested. The Scoop reports our achievements on the field, in the arts, in poetry, and beyond. From the social reporting of Thera Mark Milling, a former colleague, to the people's historian, James Spady, from the conscious pen of Junius R. Stanton to the Philly beat of Yanina Carter, the Scoop USA touches the heart of Philadelphia and makes it shine. Happy birthday, Sonny Driver, the publisher and editor. And thank you for Scoop USA. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
lament Baltimore, sings of a city by the sea, but one that she longs to flee from because of its hardness and its meanness. In her unforgettable refrain, she mixes her love of the city with her longing to go elsewhere, singing, "Oh, Baltimore, ain't it hard just to leave, just to live." Simone's deep, rich contralto flew to mind when I heard of the government's report on the city's roguish police department, one seemingly bent on making the lives of black Baltimoreans as miserable as possible. According to the report released by the Department of Justice, local cops routinely violated the constitutional rights of blacks and also used excessive force against them, largely with impunity. According to a high-ranking DOJ official, cops not only stopped and frisked thousands of people in an unconstitutional manner, they beat people. They punished demonstrators engaged in First Amendment actions. They falsely arrested people. And most shockingly, they stripped people naked in the streets in blatant violation of the Fourth Amendment governing search and seizure. And they did all of these things in Baltimore's low-income and black communities. And they did this for years, for decades. Oh, Baltimore, ain't it hard just to live, just to live. Baltimore is more than a southern city. It's a majority black city with a 64% African-American inhabitants. It has a black mayor, black DA, and until recently, a black police chief. What difference did it make? To tens of thousands of black Baltimoreans, it didn't mean a damn thing. Nothing. Black politicians buried their heads in the sand while the people they claimed to represent were subjected to a sustained campaign of harassment, humiliation, violence, and terror. Only the fires that burned Baltimore after the police murder of Freddie Gray brought light to a situation of mass unconstitutional behavior by the BPD. And you better know, it ain't just Baltimore. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Donald J. Trump as the pollstar of the Republican Party has much to do with his penchant for outrageous comments, but it has much more to do with the media's need to sell soap and make money. Never before has the nation seen such numbers tuning in to view a political debate. Trump, as a reality TV star, is right at home on TV. His unpredictable style made his appearances must-see TV. The media ate it up, literally. Bigger audiences meant higher advertisement rates and bigger bonuses. The media gave this billionaire billions of dollars of free airtime. While his opponents spent millions, Trump spent pennies. He still got wall-to-wall coverage. And he got bigger and meaner and more Trumpish. The media made him. Later, they began to unmake him. We are now watching the media destruction of Trump.
They have circled the proverbial media wagons against him. Every word, every utterance, every inkling is picked apart, even if Trump isn't helping the matter. The media made money pumping up Trump. Now they're making money pulling him apart. I've written about the Clinton show. We are all now witnessing the Trump show. But this is the real reality show, and it seems to be coming to an end. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right, he's back. Yep, and he's going to keep coming back. Yep. At least that's what I think. Anyway, we got a packed show, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time fooling around at the beginning of it. At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with some people that are from a film that's like really just blew my mind. The film is called Los Punks, We Are All We Have, and we're going to be talking with the director of the film and two of the punks from the film, and it's going to be really, really exciting, so you should stay tuned to that. We'll be listening to some of the music, talking about the whole scene. Before that, we will be talking with the director, Tracy Droz Tragos. She's the producer and director of a new film called Abortion, Stories Women Tell. That's also a really incredible interview, and don't miss that. But opening the show up in a very serious measure, a very serious way. On July 25th, the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, murdered a young black man in the Nickerson Gardens housing projects in the Watts area of Los Angeles. It was all over the news, and they presented it as it was a shootout. They were just defending themselves. And as usual, the truth is quite a distance from what they're saying. And Lisa Simpson is the mother of Richard Risher. Richard is an 18-year-old youth who was murdered by the LA police. And Lisa is his mother, and she got there after she got the news that her son was killed. She lives out in Apple Valley, and she got there, and she's been fighting ever since to both find out what happened and also demanding justice for her son. I had the opportunity to talk with Lisa for a little while just a couple days ago, and I wanted to bring that to you now. So check this out. Lisa, how are you doing?
I'm hanging.
Let's talk about this. What happened on the night of July 25th?
Well, I wasn't there because I live all the way in Apple Valley, California, but my daughter got a phone call from a friend of ours that said that she needed to get in contact with me because the police had just killed my son.
It's a hell of a phone call to get.
Yeah.
And so you went down into Nickerson's.
I went down to the Nickerson Gardens. They wouldn't let me in. I was stuck right there on Central and Imperial. They kept telling me that they had people out there doing something. They couldn't let me in yet. My son's father was at the 108th precinct where they wouldn't let him in either. He was getting into altercations with the officers over there and the chief of the 108th precincts, Chief Sands, had to go down there and get him and bring him to where we was at. And he kept telling me, oh, I don't know how long it's going to be before we let you see your kid. I don't know. It's going to be a long time. So I just kept asking him, what is time when my son is dead?
You had known that your son was dead at that point.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Now, they had drawn a circle around that you couldn't break through.
Yes.
But what did you learn subsequently? What did you learn about what had happened to Richard?
When I arrived there and I was trying to find out what was going on with my son, my baby father ran up to the police car and was like, y'all killed my son. Where is he at? And all the officers, they formed a chain. They had one arm connected with each other arm and one hand on a pistol. And they standing there laughing at me while I'm in the middle of the street crying for the loss of my child.
You know, the cops tell a story about what happened to Richard. They tell a story that seems like it came out of a Wild West shoot 'em up.
Right.
That they sold as grouping of people standing out there, these young people, and they said, all of a sudden when they come up, one of them splits and runs, and he's running down the street, and he pulls out a gun and starts shooting back at him, at this cop that was following him, and the cop had to heroically draw his gun out and shoot him. What did you hear happened?
Not that story. I heard that my son, yeah, he ran. They were chasing him, and they killed him in cold blood at the end of the chase. He was just running because of the gunshots. He didn't do nothing wrong. He was just running. And when he got to the end of his trail, people over there was saying that he put his hands up and said, I don't have nothing. And the police told him to get on the ground. And he was like, nah, if I get on the ground, y'all going to kill me. And they killed him anyway.
I read somewhere that a news reporter had actually come up to you and said, basically was saying, look, there's a true story and there's a lie that's being told.
Well, that the newscaster came and told me, he said, your son was running and he got hit. He got caught up in a gunfire. Some people were shooting the police and somebody else was shooting. He got caught up in a gunfire. And he went from being caught up in the gunfire to after they did what they did, the suspect.
I read somewhere where they had fired over 20 shots.
Yeah.
Involved in that. That
was I heard true. It was like 30 to 40 rounds or something like that. And my baby only weighed like 115 pounds.
I know another witness actually was a woman who lived in the projects, right?
Yes.
And she told you some stuff about what happened too, right? And I thought that was pretty courageous of her, but also pointed a finger at the guilt of the cops.
Right.
Let's hear about that.
That the police, after they killed my son, they ran past him, came back to his body, kicked him, spit on him. Then when they flipped him over, they said they didn't even know if that was the suspect that they were chasing.
I read somewhere where Richard also had gone down on the ground after he had been shot. And they're saying that when he stood up, he reached down, he went down to his waistband, and they thought, you know, whatever.
No.
What was the real story?
The real story was he put his hands up. He said, I don't have anything. I'm hit. Grabbed his wound where he was hit at, and the police proceeded to do what he wanted to do, take his life. He wasn't armed or nothing. He was already hit, so what was the use of you killing him?
Now, you know, you've talked about a number of people who saw this stuff happen. Now, as I understand it, one of the witnesses, the cops made a big attempt to intimidate her, right?
A few of them. They're over there intimidating the people because they don't want the truth to come out.
What are they doing to people?
Telling them they're going to get search warrants to run up in their house, threatening them about their housing. They're going to get their housing took from them. I mean, it's sad. Like, y'all killed a kid, and now y'all trying to justify y'all wrongdoing by harassing the people that live in the projects that know the true story. And these people are scared to say what they want to say because you guys are already intimidating them.
When you asked questions about how you were going to find out what actually happened, because you're hearing what the truth was from the people, and you're saying, I want to find out the story the cops are saying. What did they tell you when you asked about that?
They haven't told me anything yet, sir. I went and did a march last Tuesday downtown Los Angeles. One of the officers that was out there, I guess he's a chief or something like that, he came up to me and he said that somebody was going to call me within 24 hours, and I've been waiting a whole week for 24 hours to come. They just haven't seemed to make it here yet. So,
yeah.
You know, I went down to the commission meeting today. You know, I spoke to the people, you know, because I wanted to let them know how I'm feeling. You know, it's like they shed me out. They killed my kid, but now they're shedding me out of everything. They won't tell me nothing. They did an autopsy on my son without my consent, said I had no jurisdiction. They cut him up, shredded him up to pieces. It's just sad how they work. And then they want to make you seem like you're the person. That's the bad person, but it's not you. It's the system. The system is corrupted. They ain't trying to change it. It's going to be the same until we change it.
Just so people can understand this, because look, your son was gunned down in cold blood, and then he was painted to be something that he wasn't.
Right.
That there was an attempt to really paint your son as this sort of like, well, he was a gangster that was running, you know, running with all this stuff and doing all this stuff. Let's talk about who Richard was.
That's not even true, because Richard got in trouble when he was 12 years old. We was living in Moreno Valley. For joyriding on a golf cart. They tried to give him 14 years. I wrote a 5-page deposition against the juvenile judicial system for the judge that tried juveniles. He got removed off the juvenile judicial system where he'll never be able to try a kid again, but he ended up doing 5 years. So he was in jail from the age of 12 years old to 17. So I'm still trying to figure out how y'all painting a picture of a guy that y'all don't even know. He just got out of jail February 24th, 2016. He turned 18 April 29th, dead July 25th.
Let's go back a minute here. 5 years in jail for joyriding on a golf cart?
And he ran away from a couple of placements. So they sent him to Kalamazoo, Michigan. He was their test. They sent him to Kalamazoo, Michigan for placement, but they didn't really know how to counsel my son because they normally deal with murderers, rapists, stuff like that, arsonists. They never had a kid that they had to counsel for joyriding, so they didn't even know how to counsel him, you feel me? But they paint this picture of him. And I never knew in juvenile hall they let you out on weekends so you can go hang out with your friends. For 5 years, he never was in a Nickerson's. And from 12 to a newborn, I never lived in a Nickerson's. I've lived in Moreno Valley. I've lived in Cabazon. I've lived in San Bernardino. I've lived in Victorville and Apple Valley. Never in the Nickerson's. And when I did live in Los Angeles, I lived on Jefferson, close to downtown. Brighton, 2952 South Brighton. That's his granny address. That's where he was living at when he was born. So for them to try to assassinate his character and try to make it seem like that's where he came from, y'all need to check his record first because y'all don't even know the man that y'all killed.
There's a thing, too, that even if someone did come from the Nickerson's or hung out in the Nickerson's, that doesn't mean they're not human beings.
Exactly.
You know, that's important.
Exactly.
You know?
And that's the stereotyping that they do. You feel me? They feel like if you come from that type of environment, then you're less than. But that don't mean nothing. It's a lot of people that come from that type of environment that be successful. You know, it's all on the person. Everybody's an individual, and you have to want something for yourself because they don't want nothing for you. All they want is your life. You know, it's sad that they haven't even had the audacity to at least apologize for the wrongdoing that they did to my son. Won't give me no type of information. I'm going from here, there, everywhere. It's like I'm running like a chicken with my head cut off just to try to get some closure about what happened to my child. And there's no response from nobody. Everybody's playing a, I don't know what happened, I don't know what's going on card. All y'all know. Y'all got the report in y'all face, but y'all know it's some foul play, so y'all not trying to give it to me. Y'all trying to push me off as long as y'all can to make me stop my fight, but I just can't stop because I got the fight in me.
Look at what Beck said, the police chief. Look at what he said in relation to this, too, because he got out there and he immediately started talking about the bravery of the police to the cop that killed your son, that murdered your son. He goes and talks about him as being, he was incredibly brave. I went to the hospital and I visited him, and it just really touched me, the intense bravery that he showed in talking about what he was up against and what he did.
I mean, that's like, it's crazy. Like, you really would go to the hospital, you all on TV and giving a killer they props. Basically, you just giving a pat on the back saying, you know, hey, you killed one this week, kill five next week. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's sad because how do you have somebody like that running the police force? How do the people win? With an animal like that, the people is just doomed. I don't even consider Los Angeles Police, whatever it's supposed to stand for, Los Angeles Police Department. Nah, that's not the meaning of the true meaning of LAPD is not what they say it is. You feel me? I went to the commissioner meeting today and I just really seen a lot of things, like the police commissioner, Stevie. He's not a people person, you know? It's like every time somebody say something, oh, that's your second warning, or you're going to have to get out of here. Like, dang, you showing people that you're not for the people, and it's cool with you that they killing kids out here on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Lisa Simpson, and we're talking about her son, Richard Risher. He was murdered by the LAPD on July 25th in Nickerson Gardens. Lisa, you know, one of the things when you're talking about how does this guy become the head of the cops like that, actually, when you think about it, that's what you got to be the head of the cops.
Yeah, you got to be a killer.
Yeah.
How you get your stripes.
Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking about this. And when you're describing Richard in Moreno Valley and then being sent to Kalamazoo, Michigan, and then, you know, coming back just in February and what happens to him. And when you look back in history, that same kind of operation was going on.
Exactly.
When slaves were being treated exactly. The same way. Go ahead.
Like I told him, you know, I kept it real with him. I'm a realist. I say, you know, this country was built by the black man, but it just wasn't designed for the black man. You feel me? The only thing they gave the black man was emancipation. But we want to be free just like they free. We have not one country in this whole world that backs the black man. Barack Obama, he a black president, but he don't even back us. And then when we try to back ourselves, their alternative is to kill us because they don't want to want us to stand up for what's right. I mean, we've been going through this for too long. Racism need to be gone and kicked out the door. It's sad. You feel me? How do you just stipulate that you don't like a person just by whoever their forefathers and parents were? That's dumb to me. It's like you have no kind of common sense. God gave you five senses and people that's racism don't have it to me. It's like you're judging people and who are you to judge?
I thought of this when Beck was talking about how brave this cop was, and they were talking about how he was seriously wounded with his life pouring out of him, and he stands up and he takes out your son. You know, what was the truth about that?
He wasn't even hurt.
Say that again?
He wasn't even hurt. Like when it first came on the news, they said he was dead. Then it went from fatal to a leg shot. Then it went from a leg shot to an arm shot. And then when the smoke cleared, he was just skint. But y'all airlifted him to Long Beach Memorial Hospital and left my son out there to bleed out, and wasn't nothing wrong with this man. I mean, it's sad. Like, they said my son had a gun and they had a shootout. You see no holes in the walls of the direction he was running in. If you shooting at somebody, it should be holes that you shooting back at somebody. There's no holes. It's only holes of the direction that y'all shooting in. And then you want to just close me out and don't want to tell me nothing because you already know you made a mistake. But when you was on the scene saying you didn't even know if that was your suspect. You never seen his face. He could have been running for cover. You never know. But it's just the way they portray the image of him, like he was just this big gangster at 18. Never was raised, born, never lived in the Nickersons, hung out in there a few times. That made him that notorious. I don't understand.
Tell people what the true picture of your son is. What was Richard really like?
Oh, Richard was, he was a funny guy. He liked to smile, make you laugh. His favorite thing was dancing. You see Richard walking down the street from school, he have a headset on, you know it's him because he dancing all the way down the street to the house. He liked to play sports. He loved basketball. That was his passion, basketball. When he was in juvenile hall, one of the little sergeants in there told me that when Richard got out, he was going to put in the word for him so he could play semi-pro rugby. He said for him never ever to play the game before, he said he had the sport down to a science. And I was like, wow. He played football for the Snoop League when he was younger. They won the championship. He was in videos. when they won the championship, or songs that they did. He was a good kid. You know, all kids had they individual, so they got their own mind. They do their own thing. But overall, he was a pretty good kid. He wasn't disrespectful, because I didn't raise him like that. That's why everybody has so much love for him, because I taught him to be respectful. You feel me? It's just hurting me because that was my heart right there. And now it's gone, and nothing that can replace it. You feel me? Mm-hmm. There's nothing that can replace it, and it's getting closer and closer to his day, and it's just like, it's tearing me down. It's tearing me apart. And I can't say nobody know how I feel until they lose a child. You feel me? And for the police to just assassinate my son like that and don't feel like they owe me an explanation, it's unreal to me. It's like, this is a dream to me, and I'm going to wake up, and my son going to be here.
You have been also fighting this. You mentioned going down to the police commission, but you've also been fighting this in the streets.
Yeah.
And I understand you think it's pretty important to be doing that.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me what you've been doing and why you think it's important to do that.
I've been doing marches. The first march was on 112th and Central down to the 108th precinct. The second march was at the police station on 1st and Spring. And I feel it's important because if I be quiet, then they just going to brush this situation under the rug like it never happened. And I feel like the whole world needs to know how corrupted L.A. Police Department is. And they've been like this for many a years. It's so ironic because this is not the first person that LAPD killed in my family. In 1981, they killed my cousin, Roy LaMelle Jr. And it's like, dang, history repeating itself. You feel me? You know, they get these people in here and it's like we don't even matter. Like our kids don't matter. We don't matter. They don't want us to say nothing. They just want us to be quiet. I mean, we're supposed to have a voice, too. You feel me? My son's life mattered because he wasn't a bad kid. And he also had a full scholarship to any college he wanted to go to. Any college he wanted to go to. He didn't play basketball with the police and the Nickersons. So if he was so bad, why would they even take their time out to even associate with a kid that they knew that wasn't nothing? It's just a whole bunch of lies about my son, and I just feel like that's not right.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that I'd ask you is that you've seen over the last couple of years, and especially over the last few months, it's become major, major news. But there's something that's going on here. And I think one of the things I was thinking about is you're telling a story about Richard's life and the fact that it runs back in your family, that you have a story about two murders. Then you also have a story, I would imagine, of the kind of life that black people have been forced to live here.
Right.
We live in a society, when you look at all this stuff, the murder that goes on time after time after time, and it never stops. It never stops, and they're never punished. Freddie Gray,
yeah,
his spine was broken in a van and taken him in a paddy wagon, supposedly taken him to jail.
Right.
And every cop is let off.
Right.
What does that make you think about?
It make me furious. It make me think about forget just trying to get justice. You feel me? Like, it's like they can do whatever they want to do to us. They can kill us, break our bones, beat us up. And it's like we can't even do nothing as a people. We can't even begin to fight back because that's the first alternative they have is to kill us. I mean, switch the roles around if that was a black person that killed the cop. We wouldn't get away with that. We'd be in jail. You feel me? It wouldn't be no explanation to trying to discredit the police officer from getting killed or nothing. It'd be, you killed the cop. But when y'all kill our kids, it's, oh, we got to discredit them. We got to make them look like they the bad person to make ourselves look better. Do you feel good when you go to sleep every night knowing that you killed the 18-year-old kid? And you just gunned him down and you feel good about that. And then you have your superior backing you up for your wrongdoing.
You think about it, that all these people have been killed and you look at this and it's not a mistake. It's not just a series of sort of, well, coincidentally, it happened here, 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 and here. And it happens time after time and year after year. I had a guest on the show, an artist from New York last week.
Mm-hmm.
He had been in this art show in New York and he had put up a flag that said, he said a man was lynched by police yesterday, and that was drawn from a banner that the NAACP had had up way long ago, you know, decades long ago,
right,
that it said a man was lynched yesterday. And when you add this police in there, it really points to something in terms of two things. There's a genocidal thing that's going on where there's an assault that's whether it's killing young black and brown men or throwing them in jail or burying them in jail.
Right.
There's a genocidal assault going on. And two, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about this question of when you said you can't fight back, because you actually don't believe that.
Oh, no.
You do fight back.
Oh, yeah, I fight back. Yeah. Like I told them today, only way they're going to stop me, they're going to have to kill me like they killed my son.
Just in closing, I did want to get back to one thing, and that is how important you see fighting this battle, the fighting this in the streets, being out in the streets, mobilizing people to do this. Why?
I feel like it's very important because my son will be mad at me. He'll be like, dang, mama, you've been fighting for me all my life, and you wait till they kill me to stop your fight. So I have to keep pushing on. I can't stop. It's a cold beast out here in this world. You feel me? On these streets. And the beast is the police officers. And the saddest part about it is when they killed my son on July 25th, they killed 8 more kids in the LAPD. 8 more people died after my son. And it's like a purge on black people. You know, first they start killing the black men. Now they're killing the black kid. In a minute, our race is going to be extinct. I mean, they doing the devil work and they smiling all on TV.
All right, Lisa Simpson, thank you very much for joining us today. And keep us informed when you're doing this, you know, when you're actually doing different things. Let us know what's happening.
Oh, right? Yeah, I will.
Lisa, thank you very much for having me. Sure.
All right. Black lives do matter. Trust.
Absolutely. All right. Welcome back. That was Lisa Simpson, whose son was killed by the LAPD in Nickerson Gardens on July 25th. And just a word here, we'll be covering this more next week, I hope. Jesse Romero, a young Chicano, lived in Boyle Heights. He was 14 years old. He would have turned 15 on August 24th, was gunned down by the LAPD. Keep this in mind, sisters and brothers. Keep in mind what's going on in this world today, all right? Never forget that. And that's what I'll leave it with, all right? And people should be standing up against all this endless slaughter and getting to the root cause of it all as well. And let's change this world, man. Let's just change this world, all right, and do what's necessary to do that. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with the director of a new film called Abortion, Stories Women Tell. Stay tuned. You Don't Own Me, Leslie Gore. All right, there's a new film out, and it's a film called Abortion, Stories Women Tell, and I spoke with the director of that film earlier this morning, and I want you to hear the interview now. It's been 43 years since Roe v. Wade gave women the right to abortion, but that right faces more opposition today than ever. More abortion restrictions have been enacted in the last 5 years than in any other five-year period since 1973, the year the case was decided. Already in 2016, 21 new restrictions have been made law in 5 states, Florida, Indiana, Kentucky, South Dakota, and Utah. These developments are reported on frequently, but the filmmaker Tracy Droz-Tragos, the women in states impacted by increasingly prohibitive laws are the ones being left out of the debate. Her new documentary, Abortion, Stories Women Tell, sets out to give some of them a platform, featuring dozens of women who voice their abortion experiences. The film is coming to HBO in 2017, and it's premiering now in Los Angeles and a few other cities. I had the opportunity to talk with Tracy a little while ago, and this is our discussion. Tracy, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Sure, sure. It's a pleasure to have you, and I think it's really important to jump into this. Let's real quick get into it. What inspired you to make this film?
Well, I care very deeply as a woman about access to the health care that I need. I'm also a mother of 2 daughters, and I certainly hope that they can live in a country where they have access to the health care that they need. And far too long, it feels like the conversation around access to care is really monopolized by politicians and lives in the land of the abstract and rhetoric. And I hoped with this film to kind of reclaim the conversation and return it to the hands of women who are most affected to hear from them directly.
It's very heavy because, as I was saying in the intro to this, when you look at the assault that has been going on against abortion, even in just the last 5 years, it's been incredible. And when you look now, I mean, I thought actually one of the things that sort of informed your film a lot was the fact that this is a right that is quickly disappearing or being so restricted that it's almost gone in many places in the country.
Yeah, I mean, in Missouri in particular, which is my home state where we chose to focus, it's one of the most restrictive states in the nation. There is only one clinic now open that provides abortion care, and there's also a 72-hour waiting period. And the impact of that for many women, particularly, I would say, low-income women who are most affected, is huge, and it often will make the difference between being able to access an abortion and not being able to. I mean, really, really giving up, having the burden be too great.
And whether or not you're able to access an abortion, it, for a lot of people, and you see this in your film, for a lot of women, it is a thing that's actually going to dramatically impact their lives. In some cases, can even be life or death.
Absolutely. It can be life or death. It can also mean the difference between an education and not getting an education. In one story, one woman I met, she was on her way out of her small town. She got a basketball scholarship, and that basketball scholarship was taken away. She was not able to get out of her small town, and there she is. That path really cut short for her.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the particular stories of the women themselves, because this is one of the things that really stands out in this film. And just to start, this is one of the few films on abortion that have been made generally. And even then, when most of these films end up concentrating on abortion providers or on the assault on abortion, but this film actually really concentrated on the women themselves and telling their stories. Why did you pick that? Why did you do it that way?
Well, I mean, it felt like that was a part of this that was missing, and it's hard. I mean, it's very, very hard for women to come forward. I would say probably especially in my home state of Missouri, where there's an added layer of shame and stigma, and it's a particularly conservative climate. But it's very, very important that we, you know, make sure to give voice to women. Without that, you know, we're in the land of rhetoric and abstraction, and it's very easy to dismiss why women, you know, need to have abortions at all. So the intention really was to hear from women directly, not shadow their faces or disguise their voices, and not treat them as if they were involved in some kind of criminal activity, but to hear from them directly with full faces and full stories, and to include as many stories as we could so that we could really demonstrate as much as we could the circumstances women face.
You know, it was very heavy watching and listening to these women coming forward to tell their stories themselves. I mean, it was amazing because you look at this and you got all kinds of people, including at one point you include one of the pro-lifers that actually had to have an abortion and got permission from her church to get an abortion and all this stuff. But you're really looking at a very particular thing and a very important thing in terms of women themselves having to make these decisions. And then oftentimes finding themselves, as you were pointing out, that, you know, you're isolated off from a whole lot of other things going on, even a support network in society. I wanted to ask you this. What was the stories that really impacted you the most?
Well, I mean, it so many of these women touched me, but I do think, going back to the story of the woman who lost her basketball scholarship, I mean, she didn't have access to the care that she needed. She at first wanted to have an abortion and was unable to get the gas money to drive the long distance that was required because there wasn't a clinic near her. Eventually tried to work with an adoption agency to place her child for adoption. Was unable to do that because the father expressed some interest in maybe, you know, being a father one day. So the agency rejected her, and she now has a child that she didn't plan on having nor necessarily wanted. And that's a story that sticks with me a lot.
Yeah. You know, one of the ones that really got to me is this, the woman who was saying that if she had this baby, she was in a relationship where this man was beating her and that he would probably beat the baby out of her anyway. And you're thinking about, damn, what kind of future would that woman have? And what kind of future would any baby born into that kind of a situation have? And if you don't have the right to an abortion, this is condemning at least two people to a life in hell.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and there are so many stories also that stick with me that are not included in the film because it was just too sensitive, or, you know, there are people who I met who were victims of rape. There were very, very, very young patients at the clinic, as young as 11 years old. And, you know, those stories are incredibly heartbreaking. But, you know, there's also, it was very important for me to include what might feel like a more average story as well. But nonetheless, the need is still great. Amy, who is in the film, sort of a thread in the film, is, you know, a working mom. She's got two kids. She's got two jobs. She works 80 to 90 hours a week. She's trying to put food on the table. Her job is as a waitress and a bartender. And she can't be on her feet and have another pregnancy. And she makes a choice for herself and also for the two kids that she has that she does not want to go through with this pregnancy.
You know, it's interesting because
her choice needs to be respected, too.
Yeah, definitely. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker Tracy Droz Tragos. And we're talking about her brand new film, Abortion, Stories Women Tell. And the film is opening up in various places around the country, so you should check your local listings and see if you can find it. And if you can't, it is going to be shown on HBO in 2017. One of the things that actually really struck me, too, is that, you know, you see all these abortion films, which have been very important, you know, the After Tiller, Trapped more recently. It tells the story from the standpoint of the abortion providers and the people involved in that clinic and in those clinics in one way or another. But you actually chose to actually tell these stories to these women. And I thought it was really important because these are the stories that never really get told. They get passed on secondhand, but you never hear the voices or see the people whose lives are really dependent upon this right to, you know, their lives and even their humanity to a certain extent in society is dependent upon their right and ability to have an abortion if they want one.
Well, I was just going to say that I'm grateful that the women who did share their stories trusted me to come forward and to be a part of this film because it was a big ask. And I think that's part of why there maybe hasn't been more films that give voice to women. Because it's still hard for women to talk about it, and there's still such a layer of shame and stigma around having the care that they need.
You know, one of the things you do well, too, is that you do present these other people out there, the aunties out there, the anti-abortion people out there, and who are, you know, this is the gauntlet, the final gauntlet that a woman who's trying to get an abortion has to go through everywhere there is an abortion clinic. There's these people out there that are, one, trying to shame them, trying to scare them, and yelling and hollering at them about what are you doing and holding up all these grotesque pictures and whatnot. And you actually, I found it really interesting because you actually were able to show sort of all that we've been talking about in terms of the impact on women of the need for an abortion and the right to have one, but also you were able to show sort of this continued other side of this. And I thought it was very heavy because you rarely get to see this. You don't get to see this sort of back and forth there. And in that, you showed actually some of the, I was really, really attracted to, I really liked the person in the clinic who kept yelling back at the people out there, at the anti-abortion protesters who kept yelling out, yeah, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to take care of these babies? And I thought that was like really kind of, and going up against them. And you presented that in a couple cases, including confronting anti-abortion forces on a college campus. Let's talk about that a little.
Chi-Chi, I love who you're talking about. She's a security guard at the clinic, and you know, she has to be out in front on the front lines facing protesters every day. And that's a hard job. And I admire her greatly for her kind of chutzpah, but also for her sense of humor. I mean, she just kind of is a straight talker and says it like it is. And she's a mother and she's also had an abortion. And I know that she shares that with patients who are coming in if they're really scared and nervous and of course rattled by having to pass through these protesters. She'll share her story. And, you know, you're not the only one. You know, don't worry. You know, you're going to be okay. You're not going to hell. You're not a bad person. So it was important for me to include those protesters, of course, because that's the experience of women as they come to access care. But I also wanted to hear from women who are active. They describe themselves as being active in the pro-life movement. I wanted to hear from them because I didn't want this film to be dismissed as just an advocacy piece and preaching to the choir. I wanted to take it away again from this ideological, rhetorical place and hear directly from women, as long as women were going to talk to me, not as spokespeople, but as, you know, as individuals. And so I did speak to Reagan, who you mentioned, who is active in Students for Life and who organizes these gatherings at various campuses around the Midwest. Typically, they're kind of anti-Planned Parenthood rallies, and she hands out her brochures and tries to convince people to join her organization. Now, I wanted to hear why these women came to the positions that they did. Their voices are important in this film as well.
At the same time, you also included a scene where a pro-abortion woman was actually confronting one of the anti-abortion people. And it was very heavy because, you usually get to see the intimidating presence of these people, and you don't usually get to see people being able to stand up and challenge what the anti-abortion forces are saying. And that was a very important part of the film, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's for the most part, people who are working in clinics are told, you know, don't engage, don't talk back. It's kind of a losing battle. But Chi-Chi, the security guard, is someone who kind of can't help herself, and I love her for it. And then at the student union, yeah, there is a scene where a student comes forward. Her name is Katie, and confronts Reagan with her position. And I found it incredibly provocative, and I wanted to include it. And it sort of broke the conventions of the film a little because neither Reagan nor Katie are patients, but they're both young women who are very, very much affected by the state of, you know, reproductive rights and access to care in this country. And so I thought, you know, it was important to include that moment.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more question, and that is, as I watched the film and rewatched it and just thought about it a lot, one of the things that really came down to me was the absolute importance, the fundamental importance of women having this right to choose whether or not to have an abortion. You know, it's incredible because when you think about that, for me, if a woman doesn't have that right, then she has no right to control her body. And that actually, for me, I think that that's akin to slavery, modern day slavery in a certain sense. I'd like to ask you what you think about this whole point of the importance of, because you mentioned earlier that you really came out of this film thinking about the importance of having this right. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in fact, an audience member came forward at one point and said, you know, it's a right. We have to recognize that right. It's a right that women fundamentally have and should have. And it needs to be recognized because without that, women are relegated to second-class status. I mean, it keeps women in poverty. It keeps women from being educated. It limits opportunity for women significantly not to be able to choose, you know, make these decisions over their bodies and their lives. And it came home to me in a way that I don't think ever really fully appreciated until I made this film. I'm lucky that I have had access to birth control. And from an early age, I had the education about how babies are made. And many women, it starts there. You know, they don't have the education. And in Missouri in particular, it's abstinence-based education. And then it goes to, you know, having access to birth control. I mean, nobody wants unplanned pregnancies. Nobody sets out to have an unplanned pregnancy. So if we can start, we can at least have some common ground with trying to prevent unplanned pregnancies. And that starts with education and birth control.
All right, Tracy, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk with you.
Sure, me too. All right. And the film is Abortion Stories Women Tell. It's really an important film. And it's also going to be on HBO in 2017. So spread the word. We're going to take a quick break and be right back to talk about Los Punks. We Are All We Have. All right. Check that out. All right. Stay here for it. You're going to really love it. Cut in there, okay? But we got some people in studios that are responsible for that, all right? And they're responsible for that. I'm telling you, they're responsible for contributing to the sound that goes into making up that song that is just driving me crazy. I love it. All right, and we're here now joining us now to talk about this film that I was turned on to back in January, and I kept trying to find a way to get to it. I wanted to see it at Sundance, at Slam Dance. I wanted to see it. I wanted to come back here and do it, and I kept trying to. My schedule kept getting messed up, and finally we were able to pull it together. And the film is Los Punks. All right, We Are All We Have, and it's an incredibly, really powerful, really beautiful film. And we're talking today with the director of the film, Angela Boatwright. Angela, welcome
Hi.
To the show.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure. And two people from the film, Moises from Psych Ward, one of the groups in the film.
That's me. Yeah. Hello.
And Wesley from South Central Drunk Punk.
Yes.
Where the hell did you get that name, man?
Hey, man. When you're a punk out here in South Central, you know you got to realize you got to start creating a community with each other.
Uh-huh.
So friends just became family at some point, and ever since then, we've just been throwing shows together. It's most of the family, they're actually in bands.
Well, let's talk about this. Actually, give people a sense of what is the film about.
Well, Los Punks, We All We Have is a film about one particular punk scene in Los Angeles. As we discussed earlier, there are lots of different punk scenes in Los Angeles, and Los Punks focuses on predominantly street punk scene, where they throw shows in backyards, alleyways, driveways, pretty much wherever is clever. Los Punks is, the shows are predominantly in East LA, Boyle Heights and South Central and Watts during our filming. But they happen in other neighborhoods all over Los Angeles, parts in the Valley, Compton, other places, Santa Ana sometimes too as well.
Well, let's say, Moises, what would you say about in terms of what gives heart to these, what gives rise to these shows, to this phenomenon? I mean, I know it actually has been going on for a long time.
And I think that's it. It's piggybacking on that. You know what I mean? It was already happening, and it was just kind of attracting people. And I don't think it's ever really going to stop attracting people. You know what I mean? Especially kids. You know, especially kids. I don't think it's ever going to stop attracting that kind of thing.
Why?
Why? Damn.
You don't get away that easy, brother.
I can tell you personally that it got me for just it wasn't lying to me. You know, it was loud. Anyway, it was the beat, you know. It's hard to say what really gets a certain person, you know. But what got me was the sound and the energy behind it, you know. And I think that that draws a lot of people who maybe don't feel that they can get the energy anywhere else. You know what I mean? Because once you go there, like once you're at a gig, it's a different energy. You know what I mean? The environment changes, the block changes for me. You know what I mean? It's the energy,
mm-hmm.
The understanding. Better put, the understanding. Because Wesley was saying, the community. The family, it's the fact you're understood regardless, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Wesley, let's talk to you about this, because one of the things, and I was thinking about that in terms of what you were talking about in terms of what it brought to you and what brought you to it. And there's a couple of young guys in the men and women in the film that talk about that this gives them a reason to live, you know, which is a very heavy thing. It makes us feel part of something. It gives us a reason to live. And I wanted to talk about that, you know, in terms of what you think of that. How does that resonate with you?
Hey, man, we're the outcasts. And at some point, we just all need to find out where we belong. And the punk rock scene actually makes us feel like we belong. You know, they accept us for who we are. Doesn't matter if you're gay, like straight, transgender, you know, different races. Like, even if you don't even know English, we still, like, welcome them.
Mm-hmm.
And it just comes through.
You know, it's heavy, though, too, because it's a scene that, I mean, it's built around the music, and that's what brings people there. And it's like you're saying, you have all kinds of people coming to this. I mean, these are not a garage with 20 people in it. This is an all-out major event. I mean, when you're looking at the number of people that flow into that and what the intensity of it and what people bring to it and what they get out of it, it's really interesting in terms of the, you know, the meaningfulness of it for people, in terms of giving people exactly that sense of rooted in something that's unique from the, you know, the disgusting mess that we live in, but also something that's unique and meaningful for a lot of the young people that are involved in it. Yeah, I thought I'd say
I agree.
That. Okay, all right. I'm going to take a minute to let people know that we're talking with Angela Boatwright, the director of the film Los Punks, and we're also talking with two of the punks from the film, Moises and Wesley. And for those of you who are already wondering where you can get the film, you can get it on iTunes, and I'll remind you again at the end of the show. Angela, how did you find this? How did you get into it? And what actually inspired you to do this? Why did you want to do this?
Well, it's a really long answer. I'll try to keep it really short, but I was living in New York City for 19 years, and for no particular reason, I moved to Los Angeles, and I was kind of having a hard time finding people with a similar sense of humor, super sarcastic, people that you, yeah, I can hear your accent. Yeah, people that I could mess with and people that could take a hit, you know. So I can't curse, otherwise I would say phrase that differently. But yeah, so, you know, and at the same time, I knew that LA had a really an incredible, vital history of punk. And I was wondering what was going on in Los Angeles right now, you know, and it all kind of came together. And, you know, when I got to go to my very first backyard show in East LA, and I realized, oh, one, this is amazing. This is the most amazing energy I've ever experienced in my life. And two, this is where the sense of humor is, man. Like, I can hang out with these people. Like, I can talk to them. We can, like, you know, they're not too sensitive. They're not going to overreact. We can mess with each other. So I felt really at home at shows. And like these guys were saying, the energy at shows is, it's really incredible. It's hard to describe. You kind of have to experience it for yourself, but it's almost addictive. I've had camera operators that film for Los Punks that still text me like, hey, I'm in town. Is there another show? I got to go to a show. Is there another show happening? Can we go to a show? You know, something really amazing about the energy.
The title of the film is Los Punks, We Are All We Have. Let's talk about that second part.
Sure. We Are All We Have is a song title by a band called The Casualties. Casualties are a band from New York City, actually, a street punk band, a very legendary street punk band. They're a band that a lot of the street punk bands that exist within the scene in Los Angeles, the scene that's documented in Los Punks, the Casualties are one of their favorite bands. I knew the Casualties from living in New York, and their booking agent, Ron Martinez, is a really close friend of mine. And he's one of the reasons, he's one of the people that allowed me to find out about the backyard punk scene. So I was on the phone with Ron one day. I was like, man, we're kind of trying to put together a title for this movie. And we started talking about what the scene really means. And he was like, dude, it's We Are All We Have, just like the Casualties say, it's we are all we have. And I think that that song title resonates, you mm-hmm. know, in a million different ways.
Yeah.
For the punks.
What about for you guys? What do you think about this in terms of we are all we have?
Either well, one. Well, it was We Are All We Have. It's a, that's a, Wesley.
Too late now.
No, it's like a, We Are All We Have. It's for me, it was about, it's about like when, like, why am I being so
reticent?
Is that the word?
I don't know. I guess so.
We all, like, back at, yeah, I'm useless.
So, Wesley.
Hey, man, the way I feel about we Are All We Have is that, you know what, it just says it in the words itself. And as a community, like you already know, like we're going to love each other no matter what it is, what we've been through. And at some point we forgive each other, and the beefs, they're going to stop at some point.
Well, tell me this, because you, like, for instance, if you have a gig in a yard in South Central, and for a lot of people, or East L.A., for a lot of people, you recognize that there's social formations that exist in those neighborhoods to begin with. There's a lot of gangsters. There's, you know, different sets of people that hang out, that do things. And yet you come into that. And to by and large, what I could see in the film is that there's not a lot of sort of gang interplay in there. But there's actually – you're coming in and you're actually bringing people who – I mean, it's really – it's lively, and it's a hell of an event, you know. And you see the difference that it makes in people. You see it in their faces. You see it in their conversations with each other. You see it in terms of, you know, just the whole way the whole thing unfolds in front of you.
Hey, the gangsters join us in the pit too.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, they're around. They just don't really like to be on camera as much.
So they were all those guys that were like this, right?
Pretty much. Or wearing their caps, you know.
Well, one thing is you're also dealing with, you know, the other thing is that you're also looking at people by and large. I mean, it was interesting because I was looking at this young woman who was born without a right arm. And there was something that was really captured in that, Angela. There was something that was really captured in that, because she came up there and it was like she was – it looked like she had never been happier. And the people that were greeting her, and it was just so warm, and, you know, it was just – it was a really – it really gave you a sense of a whole different relationship among people, you know, including between men and women, you know, which is another thing that seemed to be very, very heavy there, which – women could, you know, basically jump into the mosh pit. They could do whatever, you know. And it wasn't – you weren't worried about being hit on. You weren't worried about getting abused or anything like that. It was very, very, very inspiring, actually.
Yeah, the women in the punk scene, from what I can see, are at times they can be scarier than the men in the punk scene. They're definitely very strong, very strong-minded. The guys in the punk scene tend to be very protective of the women in the punk scene, their friends, you know. So, yeah, it is a very interesting dynamic. Jenny is an amazing person. Her heart is huge, And just seeing her and being around her makes you feel really great and uplifted. And she's every time, you know, going to shows for her is just an amazing, you know, shows are one of her favorite things. It's an amazing, you know, thing mm-hmm. for her. Her boyfriend plays guitar now in a metal band, and she loves to go support him and be at the show and see all of her friends. And, you know, she's always just a pleasure to be around.
You know, Angela was talking about the casualties, and both of you mentioned them as well. There's this whole scene in the film that actually brings together some of these people who would be on the older end of the whole punk scene. And they're actually talking about the importance of how punk grew up, how it grew up in terms of, and particularly for people that were in East LA, that there was this whole question that there was a lot of discrimination against Latino bands. There's a lot of discrimination against Latino punks, and that they actually fought their way through. What's the connection between you guys and those guys from the past?
Well, you know what? I deal with a lot of, like, the older punks from the past. Like, and yeah, they talk a lot about us nowadays. But you know what? I also, like, try to remind them that, you know what, it's still going alive. And whatever you guys think you started, guess what? It's still going on. Mm-hmm. And it might be a little bit faster for you old people, but it's okay.
Why are you looking at me, man?
We're still here. We are all we have.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the point. But there's also what I was getting at is that there seems to be a certain amount of more, it seems something that began in the beginning, it began with sort of a, to hell with what they're saying about us, we're going to get together and do this. And now you've got this phenomenon that's huge, you know, and it's also a huge phenomenon that nobody really outside of those areas knows about. You know, I mean, I knew friends that were much younger than me that would tell me, but they were going to these weekend things, they were going to, you know, and it was in somebody's house, it was over here, it was there. And as Angela was describing, it's in an alleyway. I thought that one thing that was literally just a driveway.
Yeah.
And you had a lot of people packed in there.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of, like, you know, it was just invigorating to watch it, you know.
Yeah.
It's very heavy. So, you know, I was just wondering about what the, you know, how you look at the ties between people more. Not so much that sort of, well, they're arguing about we're different than that. But there's some kind of space that gets created there that I was wondering if there was any, you know, fall over from that.
I think a lot of times those kind of things are really hard to articulate. You know, a lot of the punks in the scene are simply participating. They're in bands. They're going to see the bands. They're buying patches. They're buying shirts. I don't know that a lot of people think really heavily about why they're there or the history or where they're going. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, I did quite a bit of research on the history of both the scenes in East LA and South Central and got to talk to a lot of punk veterans. And like Wesley's saying, sometimes the older guys will be like, well, it's always, well, back in the day, it was, man, you guys got it easy. Now, back in the day, man, you should have been here. I get posts on the Los Punks Facebook all the time, like, oh, it was crazier in the 90s. It was crazier in 2002. It was crazier in 2006. So
that pisses me off.
There's that kind of thing. But the point is, there's still a need for these shows. You know, you go to, every weekend there's a show and there's 300 to 500 people at some of these shows. I mean, to me, that says that this is important. There's a need. It might not be obvious. It might not be an obvious need, but there's something happening in those neighborhoods and in that scene that, you know, keeps bringing that amount of people back regularly. That's, to me, that's a really big deal.
Yeah, I mean, that point, that's what I was talking about earlier, referring to earlier, but the point about that, as people saying, it makes me feel part of something. It gives me a reason to live. And you can see that in the way that people are actually, it is so much a part of people's lives. You know, it's very, very, very deep thing.
I mean, a lot of the punks they have day jobs and then spend the remainder of their lives working on their band or promoting shows or going to shows or creating outfits for shows or whatever is needed, you know. So you have your day job and then you have that lifestyle. It's all consuming, which is great, you know.
Now, what about, you know, basically it's common knowledge. If you have a regular party in a house in the neighborhood, there's about a 98% chance that you're going to get visited by the police. And there's instances in the film where actually that happens. And I thought I wanted to just explore like a little bit. What is the relationship there? And what happens? I mean, do the police bust these things up a lot?
Honestly, it depends on the area you're in. And in East LA, I've been to a lot of shows that have gotten raided and like really early, even before a band even starts, just because there's a bunch of people arriving. Then in South Central, sometimes it'll last till like 2 a.m. or sometimes even 4 a.m. And you know what? Some of those cops out there actually are old school punks. that they'll just pass by, like, hey, I like that band. What was the name of that band? And be like, oh, find out if you can find it on Facebook. But, you know, and that they'll try to join us. Like, even fire department has joined us. Like, they'll get off their shift and then they'll still come in uniform and get in the pit with us.
Although I do have to say in the film, one of the things that really was outrageous was that those cops that raided the one party and were just lining everybody over here. And they were coming in and just like it was like so insanely brutal in a certain sense.
Well, do you want a little backstory on that? So that was a week after the Mike Brown incident. So LAPD was obviously very mobilized at that time. I would imagine that they're still fearing another LA riot like 92. Or God forbid something from the 60s. So they were very mobilized. And if you look at the police in that section of the movie, you have a very diverse selection of police officers, Asian and black and white and Hispanic, and kind of very cornucopia of police officers. But also, police cannot enter private property unless there's a fear of life or death. So they had gotten a call from someone who had said that somebody had been stabbed at that show. And that's the reason that the cops were able to enter that show. But just a little behind the scenes secret, a rival promoter called that raid in.
Okay.
So
damn him.
Yeah. He wanted that show to be raided so that everybody would come to his show. So,
all right. We're just about out of time, but I want to really thank all of you for coming in. Angela, Moises, Wesley, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Listen, folks, the film is Los Punks, We Are All We Have, and you can get it on iTunes, right?
Yeah, iTunes.
And it's a tremendous film. You're not going to regret it. Go to it. Get it now. It's uplifting, and you learn a lot. And plus, you hear a lot of good music, all right, and a great story. So check that out on iTunes. All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with the producer, director, and some of the musicians from the movie Los Punks, We Are All We Have. And I want to thank all of my guests today, Lisa Simpson and Tracy Dros-Tragos, the director of the film Abortion, Stories Women Tell, and my guests that I've just been talking with. And I want to thank all of the people that worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, Teddy Robinson, who once again is standing up and being the board op today, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. It's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com, all right? We're going to go out now with Stand from Sly and the Family Stone because it just seems so damn pertinent these days, all right? Once again, Stand from Sly and the Family Stone. Talk to you again next week.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
There's a midget standing tall,
and the giant beside him about to fall.
You got to watch.
That was Bob Avakian and Cornel West talking about why are we still fighting for justice in 2015. Now, this is a segment from the DVD Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian.
You can get the whole DVD at revcom.us, which is where you can also find much more about Bob Avakian, his leadership, and his new synthesis of communism. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, revolutionary artist Dred Scott, and also Bob Avakian and Cornel West for making available their dialogue on a DVD at revcom.us, as I already said. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Matt Kriklinski, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Rock El Casbah from Rashid Taha.
Head.